You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Mike Gravel. Mike Gravel is a former U.S. senator who opposed the war on Vietnam, entered the Pentagon Papers into the congressional record. He has been an activist and an advocate for democracy and for peace for decades. He is a current candidate for U.S. president in the Democratic Party primaries. See MikeGravel.org. Mike Gravel, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for coming on. So I understand you're running in order to be in the debates. Can you explain that briefly?
Well, a couple of young kids, David Oak, who's 17, and Henry Williams, who's 18, and a few others have joined in. David called me and asked if I would run for president. And my response was, do you have any idea how old I am? And he said, no, that's not of concern to us. It's the issues that we're concerned with. And we feel that you're the most ideal person on the issues that's running for office. And so the top priority item that they were ascribing to was my concept of building a legislature of the people. And so when they locked onto that, they really were hitting what floated my boat, and that is the creation of a legislature of the people. I'm just in the process of finishing a book, and the title of it says it all, Human Governance, The Failure of Representative Government, and a Solution, The People. And that book should be out in midsummer. And I would hope that there would be enough people that would begin to realize that the answer is not where the government leadership is, because there's really been no change since the founding of the country back in 1787-88. And so now we face this dilemma big time where the structure of governance has not kept abreast of our scientific inquiry, our scientific discoveries, and the changes that they've brought about. We have, as a civilization on the planet, have never been better off in all the metrics. However, we have two serious threats, even with all the failures that we've had in governance. And the serious threat is one, climate change, which unless we really make some fundamental changes, and we have not as yet globally, then this, the planet over maybe a millennia will commit suicide, will destroy itself. And, of course, that's the long arc of the threat facing us. The short arc is, of course, we may well destroy ourselves with our nuclear capability. Right now, and this was started under Obama, where we are refurbishing our entire nuclear arsenal. Of course, this is in the face of the Non-Proliferation Treaty that we signed, where it says that that all the nuclear states should make an effort to bring the nuclear threat to zero. And, of course, we've not done that. We're in disobedience of the Nuclear Proliferation Agreement. And so what we see now is that the Congress has approved and is, the government is in the process of spending, that is the Pentagon, $1.7 trillion on refurbishing our nuclear arsenal. Now, if you look at the record of government with cost overruns, you can estimate that what this is going to cost us is $3 trillion plus. And what's really tragic about this, because we're depriving this money from single payer health care, which could be funded this way, and school education, taking away all of the problems that the students have with these crushing bills that they have to sustain to get an education. So what will happen is that the government will spend this money, but to understand how this is the mother of boondoggles, you must appreciate that these weapons are not usable. Nobody can use these weapons, because if you do, you will trigger planetary suicide, because what will happen is we'll trigger a nuclear winter. So whether we have, and of course we're the only country that has first strike capability, but whether we have first strike or the capability to strike in a response, retaliation, you don't have to worry about the cost of retaliation, because the first strike is going to be setting the country on an immediate suicide. So what's going on with this nuclear refurbishment is essentially setting up a suicide pact for the planet. And this is being paid for by American taxpayers for weapons that cannot be used. Because if they do use them, it's the end of the planet's survival.
Well, I couldn't agree more, and I appreciate you making it a campaign issue. It may be worse than a boondoggle, because increasingly in the U.S. government, they talk about them as if they were usable, even though, as you point out,
which is a sick situation, very sick situation. The head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff had said that this is the top priority of the nation. Now, understand what they're talking about. This refurbishing the nuclear capability, they're talking about additional new submarines, additional new aircraft, the cruise missiles. It's not just the warheads, it's the it's the expansion of this capability. But using the treasure that's so vital to the success of our society is unbelievable. And of course, the leadership, the political leadership and the Congress are all culpable in this regard. Here, just pay attention to all the candidates running for president, and the only one that deals with the military-industrial complex is Tulsi Gabbard, and now, to a degree, Bernie Sanders. The rest of them don't even acknowledge the existence of the problem. So can you imagine, regardless of, I think if Tulsi and Bernie get elected, they won't be able to do all that much, because the military-industrial complex controls our government, the Congress, and regardless of who's president, the Congress is going to be locked in battle with that. Even though it's a Democratic Congress, you still have the military-industrial complex that will control our government, our culture. It's a militaristic culture at this point in time.
Yeah. So, well, there are candidates like Marianne Williamson and numerous other Democratic and independent candidates who, to various slight degrees, do touch on the topic. It's always dangerous to say the only candidate. I mean, the New York Times this week had an article about which Democratic Party candidates would qualify if the debates were now to be in the debates, based on contributions and on polling, and showed most of them qualifying to be in the debate, but didn't mention your existence. So there's some other barrier you have to surpass to get the New York Times to acknowledge you exist.
Well, then they won't. They won't. Well, rest assured that.
Where are you in terms of reaching those thresholds to get in the debates in terms of either polling or contributions?
We're pushing 30,000 votes. Donations,
and you need 65
over 80, amounting to $80,000. In addition to that, we on a number of polls, we have polled more than 1%. So it would have been, now the deadline is May 15th. Whether the students received into meeting that deadline remains to be seen. But understand one thing, that the reason why I am not considered a candidate is not because of age. It's because of my position in wanting to rein in, seriously rein in, the military-industrial complex. Robert McNamara, as he left office, was asked, he's the Secretary of Defense under Lyndon Johnson, he was, and also Kennedy, he was asked, what could we cut the Defense Department budget without impairing our security? He said 50%. Now, this is a knowledgeable person who was Secretary of Defense, knew the problem, and he felt you could cut the defense budget by 50% and not in the slightest impair our security. And I feel the same way now about that. Now, when you watch, what's going to happen is they're going to try to thwart Bernie Sanders and Tulsi Gabbard because they are talking about and educating the American public to the threat of the continued control by the military-industrial complex and these interminable wars that ensue as a result of the military-industrial complex wanting to sustain the profits. You can't sustain profits unless you manufacture these tools of destruction, and you can't use these tools of destruction unless you go to war, and then you use them up and you get to replace them. It's a vicious cycle that, in my mind, the only answer is not within the government. It's within the ability of the people to make laws. Laws are central to our society, and until the people can adopt a procedure, and I've outlined one in this book, the detailed procedure, and also in Citizen Power, which was published 10 years ago, but this is now being updated and focused on entirely within this new book, which will be able to, people could read it in one sitting.
I've looked at the websites and the statements of all of these candidates, and I, of course, agree with your assessment regarding Sanders and Gabbard, and that's already happening. But I find the most substantive answers and best answers in terms of policy platform on MikeGravel.org. I think perhaps in part because of your support for something approaching direct democracy, you're actually telling people what they would get if they elected you president. I've written a couple of articles where I ran through, you know, various questions that I think every candidate should answer. And for many, I couldn't find any answer at all. And for others, I found, you know, answers that satisfied me to various degrees. Can I try to run through a few of those policy questions?
You certainly may.
Okay. You sort of touched a little bit on this first one already, but first one is, what would you like the U.S. discretionary budget to look like? What percentage should go to what? With over 60% now going to militarism, what percentage should that be, and where should the money go?
Well, the percentage for militarism should be 50% of what it is presently, and where that money should go. And you can supplement it with additional taxation on the wealthy. That money should go to, one, health care for everybody, single payer, and education, free education for everybody from kindergarten to PhD status. A country like Iran, which we denigrate in our media, I was over there, and I can attest to it, and that is that education is free. At the end of various periodic periods, all you got to do is take a test, and if you meet the criteria, you can move on to the next level. So I hope that answers your question. Judge your civilization, incidentally, by two criteria, how it treats the young and how it treats the elderly, and we fail in both counts.
I would add how it treats the poor and the imprisoned. I think you answered possibly three or four questions there, because I also have how do you want to spend the money kind of questions.
Well, I agree with your comment on the poor.
Yeah,
it's obscene. It's a national obscene event to see people living on the streets. A wealthy nation like ours, where people go hungry and have no shelter to speak of, and where they really a good number of them have mental problems that need to be dealt with in a direct kind of way, and we don't.
So here's another question. With super profitable corporations paying no taxes, with individuals with super high incomes paying a lower tax rate than ordinary people in many cases, with a regressive cap on taxes for Social Security, with no wealth tax, with no tax on most estates, what would you do to make taxation less regressive and more progressive?
All of what you just mentioned should be corrected. The large companies that are unresponsive in society or really are abusive to the equality in society, is we should have a system of taxation that is progressive, very progressive, and funding not only our government, but proper funding for the United Nations, which should become the policeman of the world. And is not, and if they were to become policemen of the world, we wouldn't have to have that cost, because we're the self-appointed policemen of the world, and it nurtures our empire, and this, of course, is nurtured by the military-industrial complex.
Would you democratize that United Nations, give up the veto for the world's biggest war makers?
Oh, God, yes. We're not mature enough at this point in time, but I think if we were to empower the people to be able to make laws, that they would insist on this at some point, and that would be to turn around and take the General Assembly and have that work on a majoritarian basis, like our House of Representatives, but with a criteria. This means that China and Indonesia and India would have the largest majorities. But those majorities could be discounted by how much goes to the average citizen with the with their economic power. And of course, we would take the Security Council and do away with the veto and have the members of the Security Council based upon the productivity of the society. So that would take all of the major nations that would serve on the Security Council without a veto power, and it would essentially be the policy, the policy making. But well, we could go on into great detail. I'll have a chapter on that in my book that I'll be publishing. But here again, empowering the people to make laws is a very intricate process. And it's a deliberative process. You can't do what they did with Brexit, put out a referendum, let the people vote on it without educating the people to the consequences of their vote. And they have not done that. You can obviously see the ridiculous situation that exists with Great Britain at this point in time. Keep in mind, when you see a referendum, it's what is referred to the people by the government. And it's skewed in a certain way, and that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the people are able to initiate and enact laws that comport to their self-interest, the self-interest of the people in a broad manner.
We're speaking with Mike Gravel, candidate for U.S. president, who needs public support to get into the Democratic Party primaries and articulate these popular positions there, many of which will be missing otherwise. Mike Gravel, do you support a Green New Deal? And if so, what does it look like?
It should be the top priority of government, which is the same. There's only two priorities, because both of them have the ability to destroy the planet. So a Green New Deal is a philosophical approach to determine the commitment that must be made by the political leadership and by the people. This won't happen with leadership role, which, of course, we've destroyed with Trump, but a potential leadership role in the world to bring about this Green New Deal. And once you make that philosophical commitment to do something, then the implementation is not all that complicated. Here, we obviously the carbon tax to address the carbon that's going into the atmosphere, and we need to be able to put a cap on carbon production items. We're de facto having a cap on coal, but that has to be accelerated. We have to accelerate on a planetary basis our ability to transfer to issues, economic issues, that have no impact on the on climate. And I think it can be done, but as far as the commitment being made at this point in time, you just saw what AOC was ridiculed in the Senate when Mitch McConnell brought it up for a vote,
right,
and unanimously. And all this indicated to me was the level of stupidity within the Congress, particularly the Senate, both on the Republicans, which led the battle to ridicule this, and, of course, the Democrats, who foolishly voted to support this ridicule.
Could not agree more. We're going to run out of time. Let me see if I can get in a few more questions. Mike Gravel, what should the minimum wage be in the United States, and should that wage be set to keep pace with the cost of living?
Well, first off, it should keep pace with the cost of living. $15 is what is bandied about. I think that is just the beginning. No, we need an employment program that permits people to acquire ownership of the capital products. And so if a truck driver is being put out of a job because of the truck being able to drive itself, then the government should provide the economic loan for the truck driver to buy the truck so that he can live off of the profits that the truck will make. And you can do this right across the board. So that's just the beginning.
What program of economic conversion to peaceful enterprises would you support, if any?
If we're going to compete with China, we need a maglev system all the way across the United States, like a network. And of course, Siemens was the one that developed the maglev, and Chinese now have acquired the technology. We could have our military corporations like Grumman and others to cause them to transfer their capability to peaceful activities and infrastructural improvement, not just the same old stuff, but really cutting edge stuff so that the quality of life will benefit everybody in this country.
Mike Gravel, would you end, continue, or escalate U.S. wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Pakistan, Libya, or Somalia?
End them all immediately and begin to close bases worldwide so that we only have one or two bases in the world.
Where would those one or two be left?
In Mediterranean, a naval base in the Mediterranean, and a naval base which we have in Japan at this point. That's it. We don't need anything more than that.
I wish we had another hour to get into why we need those two. What about NATO? Do we need NATO?
No, I've been opposed to NATO for a long, long time. And, of course, when the implosion of the Warsaw Pact occurred, it was just ridiculous that we retained NATO. We don't need NATO.
What about the CIA? Do we need the CIA?
No, I think we could cut back on a lot of the activities that the CIA does, and also with NSA. Both are budgeted through secret budgets. People don't even know. Most of the Congress don't even know what those budgets entail.
What about ROTC, training and recruiting in schools? Do we need that?
No, I think what we need is a program that if young people want to go into public service, they could, in some degrees, go to the military, but they could go to Peace Corps activities. They could go to diplomatic activities around the world. It would be educational, and it would be humanitarian activities.
There's a big national commission holding hearings and discussion over this period of months on whether the Selective Service draft registration should be expanded to females or be eliminated. It is now unconstitutional for it to just be for males. Would you expand it to young women or get rid of it?
Get rid of it. And of course, the conservatives are really never going to bring back the draft, which I opposed and forced its end. But the reason why, if you're going to have the draft, you should draft young women in addition to young males. But we don't need that. We don't need that at all. And we don't need the size of the military that we have on a voluntary basis at this point in time. We could shrink. Here, let me go back to we could cut the military budget and obviously the personnel that sustains it by 50%, and we would not in the slightest impair our security.
Oh, I think we'd improve it significantly, and I think we would spark a reverse arms race from other countries in the process.
Oh, that's a given. Once we gave people an example with research, in fact, one of the things that the easiest thing we could do right now is to cut out the two legs of the nuclear triad. That is,
yep.
the nukes that go to the Army, that go to the Air Force. You know, we've got 12 submarines, Trident submarines. Each one has 280 warheads. One submarine could hold the entire world hostage. You could unilaterally, don't try to discuss it with other nuclear powers. Just cut away those two areas of the triad and then see if we can't join on an equal basis the seven other nuclear powers to arrive at an agreement to go down to zero on nuclear capability.
Well, I would love to hear this burst of sanity make its way into a televised presidential debate in the United States, and I know that's what you're trying to do. Mike Gravel is a former U.S. Senator and a current Democratic Party primary candidate for U.S. President. The website is mikegravel.org. Senator Gravel, thank you very, very much for taking the time to come on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, if someone makes lots of money by, say, knowingly and cynically exacerbating opioid addiction, is it okay as long as they give some of that money to an art museum? Cultural institutions are important sites of public conversation, but the public doesn't have much say in who gets to lead that conversation or the stories they tell. Activists are asking us to talk about what that means and what it would mean to change it. We'll talk about accountability for cultural institutions with Amin Hussein, core organizer with the group Decolonize This Place. Also on the show, 65 years ago this month, the Supreme Court ruling Brown versus Board of Education ordered the desegregation of America's public schools, declaring segregated schools inherently unequal. 5 years ago this month, as media marked the 60th anniversary, Counterspin spoke with journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones, whose Segregation Now series for ProPublica described 21st century Tuscaloosa, Alabama, where, she noted, nearly one in three black students attends a school that looks as if Brown never happened. We'll revisit that conversation on resegregation on today's show. That's coming up, and we'll get straight to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Last month, the American Museum of Natural History decided it would not allow its Hall of Ocean Life to host a gala for fascist Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro. The institution evidently persuaded that the guy who's opening new parts of the Amazon to mining, stealing land from indigenous communities he likens to chickenpox, and aggressively defunding science was an inappropriate subject for celebration in that particular space. It didn't happen out of nowhere. The outcry and its success built on work that's been going on for years now, calling for accountability from cultural institutions. Our next guest is deeply involved in that work. Amin Hussein is an artist and a core organizer with Decolonize This Place. He joins us now by phone from here in town. Welcome to Counterspin, Amin Hussein.
Thanks for having me.
Let me ask you first a sort of big question. The theater, museums, art galleries, they're seen in the United States as noblesse oblige, rich people giving back for the public betterment. Is part of the difficulty of demanding some kind of accountability or even transparency the way that these institutions are structured from the get-go and who they see themselves as accountable to?
Yeah, I mean, we've been looking at these cultural institutions for a while, and, you know, they're not supported publicly in any material way. So then they rely on one percenters, if we can just use that language loosely. And I think within that, they end up not hospitable to communities that they claim to serve. But yet they paddle the idea of like, oh, this is a community space. Everyone's welcome. You are part of the public. The public is who we cater to. But in fact, there's a whole other economy going on in which the people with a lot of money giving money to these cultural institutions are really determining what aesthetics is, what culture is, what's worth showing, who does it cater to. And it ends up excluding most of the people, if we're going to talk about New York and the city, focusing on the American Museum of Natural History because each museum has its specificity. We call it a hall of white supremacy. If you've visited the American Museum of Natural History that gets a lot of public funding, you realize that, oh, there's a hall for African people, and there's a hall for African mammals, and there's a hall for Asian people, and there's a hall for Asian mammals. But there's no hall for European people. There's no hall for white people. And these are the kind of things that, you know, you see these cultural institutions talking about education, but then what they are doing is perpetuating white supremacy in the children that go to visit. These are some of the things that we're calling attention to, but we're not naive to what's going on. In a way, museums have always been conceived of as colonial structures. They're a reflection of the society we live in. And at the same time, we know that they can be something different. And if they're not going to be something different, then they're no longer going to get a pass on both pretending to be something good, but in actually advancing bad.
Yeah. Well, we find that the same with news media, you know, who are, as we remind regularly, profit-driven businesses that are public in their impact, but not in their decision-making. Museums, as you're saying, are a site for a bigger project that involves, you know, telling ourselves about ourselves and who gets to tell that story. Well, we'll come back certainly to that broader idea, but I do want to ask about Decolonize This Place's increasingly visible work around Warren Kanders and the Whitney Museum of American Art. Who is Kanders and what's at stake there?
So, yeah, thanks for the question. I mean, Warren Kanders is a person who is the owner of Safari Land Group. The Safari Land Group owns many subsidiaries that create, as they call them, non-lethal solutions. Really what they produce, and the way this came to our attention, is they produce the tear gas that was used in Egypt, that was used in Bahrain, that was used in Turkey, that's been used in Ferguson against protesters, that was used in Baltimore. They also supply vests and holsters to the NYPD. They provide, through subsidiaries, ballistic bullets that are lethal that are used in Palestine. And so when that came to our attention, it was surprising. What was surprising is the degree by which a person like Warren Kanders could be a vice president of the Whitney Museum Board of Trustees. That was a little bit shocking, considering that the Whitney puts on shows around protests, around, you know, defining what American contemporary art looks like. And to the broader public, I think, the world looks at what the Whitney Museum puts up. And so for us, what we've tried to say, both as artists and as people living in the city to the Whitney, is that no, Kanders can't be on a board of the Whitney Museum that claims to be a progressive institution, that claims to serve a public interest. We understand that there are many Warren Kanders. You know, Davos family is on the board of trustees. You have the Crown family on the board of trustees. But what we're saying is that Kanders is a prime example of what's wrong with our cultural institutions, and that the Whitney is being held accountable. And what happens when you hold an institution like the Whitney accountable is that it sends a signal out in the world to other cultural institutions, but also to the people, to the communities that are being harmed by it, that we stand in solidarity with them, that we understand that we do have power, that we're not powerless, and that museums and institutions like the Whitney, they either are accountable to the communities they claim to serve, or they're going to be protested in a way that impacts their branding.
Right. We have such a confused view of wealth and of rich people, I think, in this country, that you can see someone who makes their money off misery. You know, there's no other way to put it. And yet we will say, well, but if they use that money and create a space where inner city kids get to look at a Van Gogh, you know, well, does maybe that all sort of balance out? And I mean, in addition to the sort of idea about the ideas, the cultural reproduction of colonialism and of white ideas of white supremacy, it's really that these institutions, in some sense, act as money launderers.
Thank you for saying that. They do act as money laundering businesses, but I think people are naive about the art world in general. I think that we as artists and as broader communities care about art and understand it has a deep value. But I think that the people with wealth, this wealth is finding a home in something called the art system. Look at Jeff Koons' piece, The Rabbit Costs Approximately $70 million. This artist has a rabbit. It costs $70 million. Why does anything cost $70 million? It's a question that we have to really contend with. And I think the answer isn't simply because it's art and a brilliant person made it. It's actually deeper than that. It houses this wealth that's stolen, and then it gets traded between people who own wealth, and then you get tax breaks or tax write-offs or off of your kind of tax ledger. And I think that this is what's happening with these institutions. These institutions make rich people look better in the way that they're doing kind of philanthropy, but it's not really philanthropy. And then at the same time, they're getting all these write-offs and hiding their money, and then their money comes out in art objects, and these art objects are somehow worth $70 million or $20 million or $10
million. Right. Well, I want to just go back and say, we heard that the American Museum of Natural History staff, many of them were you know, gobsmacked. And I know that Whitney staffers, too, many of them are with you in this fight. I mean, you know, the staff inside these institutions are part of the fight, too, right?
Absolutely. I think this is what's been really important about both the American Museum of Natural History and the Whitney Museum. And shout out to all the staff that have organized. And I think people forget that the organizing around the Whitney Museum happened with the staff. Front end and back end of the museum, over 100 staff members signed a letter asking for the removal of candors, for some principles of transparency around where the funding, and some ethical guidelines. Some money you should say no to. That's a minimum basis for a different kind of conversation. I think what we've done with our actions, going to the Whitney every week, and the eighth week is coming up, is to speak to the staff, to go in advance, to talk to them, to share food with them. We've explained, we understand the inconvenience that protest creates. We know that they are employed. We know we live in a society in which people have to pay bills, and working at the museum is one of the things by which you pay bills. We understand that institutions are complex. What we're targeting is the leadership of the Whitney Museum, and we're making sure to make, to the degree possible, to not make the lives of the employees difficult.
I wanted to ask one question about media. A Decolonize This Place press release last year quoted Whitney director Adam Weinberg in his praise of the museum as a safe space for unsafe ideas, and it reminded me of one news article I saw that lumped the Whitney campaign for the removal of candors, lumped it in with other scandals at museums, including, you know, sexually explicit art and Britain cleaning the Elgin marbles, not taking them, but cleaning them. And it sort of felt like, oh, museums are lightning rods. They get it from all sides. And aren't they very brave to allow people to disagree? You know, and I've seen some heartening media coverage, but I've also seen some kind of containing media coverage. And I wonder what you would hope that journalists looking at your work would take away from it, and what you would hope they would not.
Yeah, thank you for that question. I think as I mentioned, the stakes are high at the Whitney. This isn't about museums being a lightning rod. This is about the injustices and domination and oppression that exist in our society that materially impact our lives in this city, right, being materialized in a place like the Whitney. What that allows for us then is not to speak of isms like capitalism or, you know, state violence in a very abstract sense, but understand both how it works, how are we complicit, how are museums not neutral in that fight. I mean, people forget that when Trump was elected, the Whitney Museum patted itself on the back when it called for J20, right? J20 was all of the political, so-called political artists gathering together and speaking out against fascism. Where are they today? So you can put up a show that brings a lot of people in a comfortable space to speak out against fascism, but when you have Warren Canders, a vice president of the Board of Trustees at the Whitney, everyone falls silent. These are the kind of conversations that we want to have. We don't presume to know, I don't presume to know the answers. I just know that that's wrong. And it's also why we held the town hall. What we imagine is that outlets other than art outlets will cover this. We've seen some headway around this in terms of the Gothamist. We're on the radio show with you. This is great. I think Democracy Now! Did a little segment. But the sad thing about media is that they only cover the drama. So when we're protesting and also gathering and being in spaces doing things, that may not be newsworthy. But when we lit sage in the museum in December, the New York Post covered it, the Daily News covered it. And I think there's something about this kind of coverage that is somewhat superficial, that it follows a particular formula, when in fact the people that are doing this work are from movement, are organizers and artists and educators and young people, student organizers and elders and people from communities as far out as East New York. I mean, this Friday, we're taking over subway cars from East New York all the way to the Whitney. Because what's happening at the Whitney isn't just about a museum. It's about spaces of sites of specificity of how oppression and domination gets exercised against us. And it's a way for us to reclaim, hold accountable, and change the nature of the conversation. And we hope that more media outlets will begin to see that there's a deeper story here than simply a protest. In a way, a protest doesn't do service to the kind of thinking that's going on right now. What does it mean to reclaim a city if not to reclaim our institution?
We've been speaking with Amin Hussein from Decolonize This Place. You can learn more about their actions on the site, decolonizethisplace.org. Amin Hussein, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Brown versus Board of Education, the Supreme Court ruling demanding the racial desegregation of the country's public schools, will turn 65 this month. The ruling spotlighted racial inequities in education and spurred civil rights activism and legislation. It did not, however, lead to desegregation, such that Congressmember Bobby Scott, chair of the House Committee on Education and Labor, recently held a hearing titled Brown versus Board of Education at 65, A Promise Unfulfilled. We talked about resegregation on Brown's 2014 anniversary with Nicole Hannah-Jones. Now at the New York Times Magazine, Hannah-Jones was then a reporter at ProPublica, where her series Segregation Now appeared. Here's Counterspin's Peter Hart speaking with Nicole Hannah-Jones in May of 2014.
You chose to tell this story through the experience of one town, Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Why did you think Tuscaloosa's story was so instructive?
Well, there were a few reasons. I really felt that I didn't want to just cover that resegregation was happening, that there are lots of reports that show it's happening and say it's happening, but kind of leave it up in the air as to how it happens. And I think when you do that, then you give people the opportunity to fill in the blanks that it's kind of natural or it's just the way things have to be and it's no one's fault. I really wanted to show that the resegregation has happened largely because of intentional decision-making and that there actually are people who are at fault. So that was one of the reasons I chose Tuscaloosa. Tuscaloosa had managed to create a numerically perfect integration when a court ordered it to merge its middle and high schools into single citywide schools. And in 2000, it was released from its court order, and within 3 months of being released from the court order, Tuscaloosa decided to break apart those integrated schools and create an entirely all-black feeder system where a third of black students in the city schools would go from kindergarten to graduation in all-black schools. So that's why I chose Tuscaloosa, because I was really wanting to dig around into the intentional decisions that led to that resegregation.
You mentioned the court order, and reading your piece, you see a lot of policy choices and a lot of subsequent court decisions that almost seem to be delivering the verdict that desegregation efforts look like they're working, so we should stop doing them. One of your follow-up pieces takes a look at these desegregation orders. There are hundreds of them around the country, many fewer than there used to be. It's amazing to see, and your reporting fleshes this out, how little oversight or even tracking is happening on this very important issue of how schools are supposed to desegregate.
Absolutely. So the South went from the most segregated, absolute apartheid region of the country to the most integrated region of the country because of federal court orders. And really, from the span of 1964 to the early 70s, you saw a complete transformation of the South, where 90% of black students were attending schools with white children. And it was because of those court orders. But what we found is that there was a heavy enforcement of those court orders for a couple of decades. And then what has resulted has been a really non-enforcement of most of these court orders for recent decades. And that's for a couple of reasons. The Supreme Court has really backed away from desegregation. It hasn't ruled in favor of desegregation for decades, and it made it clear that these desegregation orders were not to be permanent and that they should end as quickly as possible. But also just a real lack of oversight and, I think, political will to enforce the orders. So I found dozens of districts where they remained under federal desegregation order, but district leadership didn't know the orders were open. They didn't know what the orders said. The DOJ wasn't enforcing. The Department of Ed wasn't enforcing. And they just were sitting dormant, even though students have rights under these orders.
Yeah, you're reading that the Justice Department isn't even sure what the number of orders is, and their list looks like it might be incomplete. It's really troubling. It's hard to understand schools and school segregation without understanding housing policy and housing discrimination. I was struck by a line in your piece about school district officials saying there was really not much they could do about the transformation in Tuscaloosa creating an all-black high school because you can't help where people live. How does housing discrimination, this is something you've written about extensively prior to this series, how does that factor into the story of school segregation?
First, let me say that in Tuscaloosa and actually in many districts, that argument that schools are segregated because neighborhoods are segregated wasn't necessarily true for all schools, particularly the high school. There was a great deal of gerrymandering of attendance zones in Tuscaloosa, which we showed through mapping. Mm-hmm. And actually, the neighborhood that the all-black high school was located in was a majority white neighborhood, but those kids were bused to a more integrated school. But more generally, housing, of course, drives segregated schools. If you place schools in neighborhoods that are heavily one race or another, you're going to have segregated schools. And in cities like Detroit, in cities like Chicago, New York, you, of course, see these are some of the most segregated cities residentially. And so they are also some of the most segregated cities in terms of schools. And that's part of what the Supreme Court in the early 70s, when it authorized busing as a form of desegregation in the Charlotte schools, was trying to break that link between housing and schools, understanding that they actually drive each other. If a neighborhood has a segregated school, people who have choices won't move into that neighborhood, and vice versa. If a neighborhood has a stably integrated school, people will tend to move into a neighborhood like that. So we often blame residential segregation on school segregation, but the inverse is also true, and that's what subsequent rulings on busing were trying to break up, that you couldn't buy into an integrated neighborhood because you may not be going to the school in your neighborhood.
Now, finally, reporters want their work to have some impact in the world. This is a very ambitious project. What do you think can come of a reporting project like this? What kind of impact can it have?
I tend to pick these really intractable issues to write about, housing segregation and school segregation. But I think part of it to me was I don't feel many Americans know this history. I think we have a very truncated, kind of rosy view of what happened after Brown. We don't understand the levels of resistance and how long it took for integration to happen. I tell the story through three generations of one family in Tuscaloosa, and the grandfather, even though he started school the year that Brown was decided, he never intended an integrated school. And the only one in the three generations who did attend an integrated school was the mother, who was that kind of in-between generation when there was real integration. And now her own child is back in segregated schools. So I thought that was important just to lay that history out for Americans so that we can understand why we are as we are. But also, of course, hoping that if people are knowledgeable that this is intentional in many ways, that this segregation is not accidental, because I think we've also let ourselves off the hook as a society because we believe in the inevitability of all of this, or that it's somehow a benign process that leads to schools being 99% Black and Latino. I wanted to show very clearly that that is not, and that reporters can dig in their own communities and look at the policy decisions that have led to the resegregation. And thirdly, on a very small scale, in Tuscaloosa, I knew there had long been people who believed that deals had been made but could never prove it. And in Tuscaloosa, there are conversations that have not happened before. There's proof that the community didn't have before. And as that community is getting ready to redistrict its schools yet again, the conversation there is very different. They know that someone's watching, and that people who want more equity now feel like they have the power to push for it.
That was reporter Nicole Hannah-Jones speaking with Counterspin's Peter Hart 5 years ago this month. The series, Segregation Now, can still be found at ProPublica.org. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on FAIR's website, FAIR.org. That's also the place to sign up for our newsletter, Extra. The show's engineered by Erica Rosato. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
Global warming. Are you tired of nightly news reporting horrible weather disasters and never mentioning climate? You need a real meteorologist like Nick Humphrey. Nick lives in the American heartland in Nebraska with his young family. So far, you won't find him on a network station, but you can find Nick on YouTube on shows like Environmental Coffee House and Black Bear News, plus his Facebook page, which is very active, and Patreon. From Lincoln, Nebraska, Nick Humphrey, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex, for having me.
Nick, why did you get your master's in meteorology?
I've been interested in weather my whole life. You know, since I was a little kid, I got stuck in a blizzard at school overnight in Seattle. So it's, you know, ever since then, I've always had an interest in learning more about the weather and climate and trying to understand, you know, how it works and why it works. You know, so that's been my sort of long-term goal over the past decade, you know, going to school and doing what I needed to do. And you know, and so it's given me a real good insight into how the world and the earth works.
One of your April articles spread around the net. It's called The Conversation No One Knows How to Have. What is that impossible conversation?
The conversation, to me, is the abrupt collapse of civilization and perhaps our extinction as a species and the extinction of other species on this planet because of abrupt climate change and also environmental destruction and pollution on this planet. You know, it's been a very difficult conversation. You know, nobody wants to talk about it. It's taboo. But as far as humans are concerned, I always feel that, you know, if we're going to be here, we're going to be a conscious species. We should be conscious of not only, you know, all of our great structures and buildings that everybody and civilization that everybody always, you know, always thinks about that makes humans somehow superior to nature. But we should also deal with the fact that at the expense of all of that was the destruction of nature, you know, and eventually possibly our destruction. And so I really wanted to hammer that hard because it's happening. It's happening around us every single day on this planet. Things are getting much worse and people are dying and species are dying. And that's something that we need to be able to talk about and discuss and have a serious conversation about.
Yeah, I mean, if you were in a school and someone was going from classroom to classroom and they were just shooting one person in each classroom, they come in, they shoot somebody, and you tell the kids, well, let's not talk about that. And the kids agree that nobody's going to talk about that. And it just goes on. That would be insane. But that's the situation we're in. The species are being pushed off the planet. And we could very well be next. And we don't want to talk about it.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, it's, you know, it's because we become so removed from nature with all of our technology. I mean, I'm a meteorologist. I'm a scientist. I deal with technology and computers and all this fancy stuff all the time. You know, but we become so removed from nature, and not just like going out for a walk, but actually being a part of nature and dealing with the rigors of living in nature. You know, the threat of nature. That as nature dies, we insulate ourselves. Either, you know, whether it's we're in rural areas or in the city, we just insulate ourselves from this destruction. And I think part of that is because for the past 10,000 years, we have basically created civilization for the purpose of doing a couple of things. Number one, protecting ourselves from nature, you know, because we live in our homes, we congregate in cities, we can protect ourselves from species that on any normal day might kill us, like a lion or a tiger or a bear. But we also use these structures in these societies that we've built to try to expand out and control nature, control rivers, control the oceans, you know, dole out land for each other and use the resources, as we call it, which is the land, you know, the animals, everything to our benefit to expand. And so now that process has led and is leading to the destruction of the very thing that we're trying to control like gods, but in fact we depended on all along, just like every other species on this planet.
There's a video blogger in the northern U.S. who goes out on his bicycle every Friday to call for climate action, and I kind of admire him. I mean, nobody joins him, and he's there in the traffic, and he's saying, this is crazy. And I apologize to listeners, I've lost that link, and I haven't been able to find him again. So if you know who that is, please email me, or if that's you, email me. But anyway, he said he was in a rural feed store and the customers were all saying they could not get out on their damaged fields to plant this year's crop. And you certainly know about that. But When our video blogger brought up climate change, everyone said, well, that's just false news. It's a liberal conspiracy. So, Nick, even when people are devastated by weather, hyped up by a changed atmosphere, they still don't get it. I don't understand it.
I think part of the reason is the human tendency to localize. And what I mean by localize is not only localize on a spatial level, you know, where I live in Lincoln, I live in Seattle, I live in Miami. So I think about the weather and what's happening here. You know, I live here. It's very, in geography, they call it activity space. This is my activity space, and this is what I know. It's also temporal localization, so people tend to normalize things. If you transported someone from, you know, I'm originally from Seattle, Washington. I grew up there and lived there until the late 2000s. If you transported someone that lived in Seattle in 1950 and transported them to 2018, they would not recognize the climate of Seattle anymore. The summers are blazing hot. Like I grew up in the 80s and 90s, and I barely recognize what's going on there now with 70, 80 degree temperatures in March and April. So that normalization, that psychological need to always see stability, means that even when there's chaos, unless it's happening right in the moment, right in front of your face, like a terrorist attack or a natural disaster or a major weather event, a single event, you don't see the pattern very well unless you try to see it. And I think that's really a big problem with a lot of people, both climate deniers, like outright deniers of the science and everything, but even those that overall, you know, accept the science of climate change, they don't see it happening right locally. And I've had debates with meteorologists and others that do not think that, you know, events, whether it be here in Nebraska or other, you know, things happening, say, in the U.S., are necessarily connected to climate change. But climate change is, of course, a global illness, if you will. And so just like an illness in a human being, you look at one symptom in isolation, you might think it's just one little thing happening. But when you realize it's happening all over the person's body and different organs and everything else, then you realize it's much, much bigger than you thought, and that's what's happening on this planet right now. And it's hard for people to see it or want to see it, because then you realize how much of an emergency and event in our Earth's history and human civilization it really is.
Well, Nick, maybe you can help me with something. Every night we watch ABC Nightly News, and we do it just to see what Americans are being told. Climate change hardly ever comes up. All the advertising selling pickup trucks and SUVs probably tells us why. But this spring, it seems like the weather is the top news story. They're talking about massive storms sweeping right across the east from Texas through Nashville, right up to New York City and Boston. There's tornadoes, there's flooding. It's like every night they have a weathercaster talking about this news. So what is the weather expert view on that persistent storm track this past winter and spring in the United States?
Well, here's the normal part. Normally in El Nino, and that's what we have going on right now, a at least weak El Nino regime in the eastern and tropical, particularly this tropical central Pacific, you do get storm tracks that favor the southern U.S. But of course, with climate change, it juices up everything, meaning literally it juices up the water that falls out of the sky. So you get heavier snow, heavier rain, higher rainfall rates that make it easier to saturate the ground. You get more flooding. And then, of course, if you get the appropriate moisture and winds in the upper atmosphere, you get the tornadoes. And I mean, last year was bad in the South for tornadoes, even as it was dead quiet on the plains much of the season because of either severe drought on the southern plains or huge, huge fires that occurred in Oklahoma while it was very cold up here in Nebraska. But now it's even worse. Very, very, very active start to the season in Alabama, Mississippi, and there's already been quite a few people killed in these tornadoes. So for me, I've always tried to emphasize with people, there's no way you can actively in real time say this event is associated with climate, this bad event is associated with climate change. You can do attribution studies, but really climate change is about loading the gun. Basically, you have events that more record events that occur relative to what you would expect with global warming. So you get more heat records, heavier rainfalls, but you also get a lot of events that are near records. They approach what you would typically see in the climate, but more often it's loading up. And then you get more of the very typical events, and it all is an accumulative effect. So maybe an area that occasionally gets very heavy rainfall suddenly gets a lot more very heavy rainfall. Then they get more typical rainfall events on top of it. You can't dry out the soil, so you get flooding more easily. It loads up your region with whatever is extreme for that region, too much water, too little water, and it ends up damaging infrastructure, killing people, killing livestock, killing wildlife, making it more difficult for the plants to understand the seasonality. So they bud very early, and then they deal with a killing freeze. That's really the effect of climate change to me. And the faster climate change progresses, the more abrupt it is, the more devastating that accumulation is, because it's occurring much, much faster than it was even in the recent time.
Nick, let's get a little report from you. What happened to the farm community this spring in Nebraska?
In short, it was catastrophic. I mean, it was just unbelievably catastrophic. There were over 1 million acres of farmland that was flooded. They were just flooded out. Many of these areas, I don't know if they've actually calculated how many of these areas will in fact be unusable land, but there will be significant areas that are unusable ever because they're covered in 3 to 4 feet of sand that came from the rivers. So the rivers flood, they take over the landscape, but because this was in many cases fast-moving water, high water, they deposited tons and tons of sand all over many of these farmlands. So now you go out there and they look like beaches with no shoreline. About 1 million calves were estimated, at least last month, to have been killed in the floods. So in many cases, cows give birth during the spring, and these calves could not handle the cold, wet conditions, and some of them may, you know, either died from pollutants or hypothermia or other threats that would be threats to people, threats to livestock as well, and they perished in the floods. So, you know, in addition, you had tons and tons of levees that were destroyed. And although the rivers have gone down in Nebraska themselves, such as the Platte River, Elkhorn Rivers, Niobrara Rivers, parts of the Missouri and the Mississippi are running very high. And I actually, just before I got on the air here, I saw that Davenport, Iowa, had a temporary levee failure this afternoon, and they're flooding right now. So it's, you know, in Nebraska itself, it was extremely bad. And now that snow melt and additional rainfall that we get just from, again, more typical events is exacerbating the flooding in downstream in parts of Missouri and Iowa. It was just absolutely catastrophic event, and likely the most disastrous natural event in terms of dollars in the state of Nebraska.
Wow. Now, you have an article called "What Does Abrupt Climate Change Actually Do to Your Weather?" That's on your Patreon site. And I'm wondering, do you expect abrupt climate change? And if so, what is that going to look like?
In short, yes. And I not only expect it, we're seeing it. Abrupt, in my definition, is profound, and we can define what profound is, but profound change within a human lifetime, basically where the whole structure of the climate system is changing, you know, within 50 to 80 years. And many people have their own definitions for when this great acceleration in climate change began, but to me, based on all the data that I've seen, I believe that it started in the 1980s. You started to see coral bleaching and the tropics accelerate in the 1980s as the oceans grew too warm. You began to see significant losses of sea ice extent, and particularly the volume, which is based on the extent and the thickness of sea ice in the Arctic. During the 1980s, you began to see greater accelerations in heat events, heavy rainfall events. It's been steadily increasing since 1950, but the acceleration in the frequency and magnitude of those kind of events picked up in the 1980s and 90s. Fires, wildfires as well. we see massive, massive fires in Siberia, the Amazon rainforest, Australia. So to me, the 1980s, something happened with the climate in the 1980s where it was a tipping point, and you started to see accelerations in the process of change on this planet. And right now, in the late 2010s, we are now seeing the near collapse of the sea ice in the Arctic. We're seeing incredible heat waves in the Arctic, temperatures rising well above freezing way too early in the season. Right now, we're seeing the melt season starting about a month and a half early in Greenland, and frequent heat events in not only the summertime hemisphere, such as Australia, which had its hottest summer on record, but in the wintertime hemisphere in Europe, in Canada. So to me, we're already in abrupt climate change. It's already been happening for much of my lifetime. I'm 35 years old. So most of my lifetime has been the process of the acceleration of climate change, but it's only going to get worse as the mechanisms that allow the planet to amplify what humans have done over the past 250 years continues to accelerate as well.
Backing up what you just said, just out in recent news, a collection of climate models from some of the big names like NOAA and the National Science Foundation project much faster climate heating than the older models did. So instead of 2.5 degrees C of warming, our current path takes us to 5 degrees of warming and beyond, and that is catastrophic. Now, if this science is confirmed, it's another game changer that the public has not heard about at all, and that really worries me.
Yes. I actually discussed this with some friends of mine today that have some understanding of climate change, and one of the things that I had concern with was the lack of connection in climate science between, say, the modelers and those in the field that go out in the field, and also climate scientists, because I've read papers, scientific papers in the past 2 or 3 years that have suggested that for a doubling of the CO2 carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere, or the equivalent of that with other greenhouse gases such as methane, nitrous oxide that you get from industrial activity, agriculture, and increasingly from the melting permafrost, that you can get a rise of 4 to 6 degrees Celsius, or about 7 to 11 degrees Fahrenheit globally, global average mean temperature, for a doubling of carbon dioxide concentration, greenhouse gases. And also a suggestion that sensitivity, as we call it, the climate sensitivity, is greater as the climate warms. So it actually increases non-linearly. So to me, seeing this from the computer models, the newer generation computer models, it's doing nothing more than confirming what was already known about the past during the ice ages with natural climate change that occurred over thousands of years or tens of thousands of years. And for me, I'm a meteorologist, and I deal with computer models all the time. These are forecast models, so they're different from climate models in terms of how they do their calculations. But one of the tenets of dealing with models is that you have to understand what they calculate and what they can't account for. And the climate models, up until recently at least, could not account for some of the more rapid changes in climates, even in the distant past, like millions of years ago, when they run the models to try to determine their level of accuracy compared to paleoclimate understanding. And they do not account for many of the feedback mechanisms that the Earth essentially uses to amplify what humans have done to the climate already to make it go to a higher temperature faster. And so, to me, the models that they've created, the newer generation ones, may be doing a little bit better job at capturing these processes, or at least implicitly in calculating them, and they're therefore showing what paleoclimatologists could have told you was probably likely based on past events, tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of years ago, and also based on what many of those in the field that study the ice and the permafrost would be able to tell you the same thing. So for me, it wasn't a big surprise except that they may be actually creating models that are getting it a little bit more accurately. And of course, that's bad news because that's pretty much what you would work with for projecting the future, and the future looks devastating for humanity.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Nick Humphrey, the meteorologist, and we're talking about the difference between what is happening and what we're being told, I guess. So as weather consumers, we're always looking to see those records break. And if a record doesn't fall, then we tend to think, well, that isn't so bad. We've seen worse than this. Nick Humphrey, what is wrong with that mental attitude?
Obviously, records matter. And if you exceed a record, and especially in a warming planet, that's a big deal. But this goes somewhat into what I was discussing in my article about what abrupt climate change actually does to the weather. Because a lot of people really don't understand what it does to the weather. As I stated earlier, it's not only about breaking records, it's about changing the very statistics of your weather phenomenon, because that's what climate is. Climate and weather are two separate things in terms of how they're defined, but they're interly connected. So climate is the statistics of the weather, type of weather events that you get. So you have, say, with rainfall, you get a certain average frequency of rainfall. You have your extremes, you know, which you've had in your climate record, however long it is, for having no rain versus having this much rain. But then you have your distribution, your typical distribution, and that can be in a day, on a particular day every year, or over a season, etc. When your planet's warming, in this case, you start to see more of those events on the margins change. So you get less, perhaps more days where it's dry. But then you get a few of those days where you get these huge, huge rainfall events that never existed in your record before. So those might be your records. But then you're also getting overall drier. And your more typical events, they either shift a little bit to dryness or a little bit to wetness, but they make whatever's overall happening in your local climate much worse. So if you're not getting a lot of rainfall, you end up adding more drier days than wetter days, and it ends up drying out your soils. And in many parts of the Southwest, this is what's happening with aridification. Your deserts are actually getting drier. Your deserts are going into a perma-drought. You know, that's what it's been called, but it's not really a drought. It's an actual change in the behavior of the soil moisture, where there's just less moisture and it just stays at a new normal, but it's never really a new normal. It just keeps getting drier and drier and drier as much as the planet's warming. Or, for example, here in Nebraska, you know, you look at even recent events where you get a jet stream that's weakening because of a rapidly warming Arctic. You need a temperature contrast to maintain a strong jet stream. Warming Arctic means that the temperature contrast weakens, and a jet stream becomes wavier, more turbulent, more chaotic, with huge waves that extend very far south and very large ridges of high pressure that send very warm air up into the Arctic and feed back on warming the Arctic. But in Nebraska, you get a lot of snow and a lot of snow and a lot of snow, and then suddenly you get abnormally warm heat from, say, Texas in the south. That flash melts that ice and snow in a matter of like 48 hours, and you have a gigantic apocalyptic flood, you know, almost, where it destroys your bridges, destroys your, it kills your livestock, destroys your farms, destroys your dams, and then you're back to some little sense of normalcy, but you just had an extreme event that was really loaded up by abrupt climate change affecting the weather in the Arctic. That's really the thing with weather, and I think that's why a lot of people, when they see these weather events, especially locally, they don't connect it to what's happening globally or what's happening in some distant, faraway land, you know, up in the where the Santa Claus lives. It's basically they can't see the fact that these things are loading up on them like a gun going off or a bomb going off. But that's what happens. You get a little bit of this, a little bit of this, a little bit of this that usually would not happen in your normal, stable climate, and then you hit a little short-term tipping point, and it blows up in your face. And that's really what's happening. Typically, that would happen once in a while somewhere on the Earth. You get these extreme events here, extreme event here. Like now I can literally do like a climate report like I did on my Patreon blog for March, and I can literally just have slides of insanely extreme events that in any given year, say the 40s or 50s, would have been notable by themselves, but they fill entire pages of slides that I present. You know, you have Cyclone Idai in Mozambique, you have extreme heat in Australia, crazy heat in winter or early spring in Europe. You have extreme heat relative to normal in northern Canada, extreme heat throughout the whole Arctic, actually, extreme heat relative to normal in my hometown of Seattle, where it was almost 80 degrees in March. I can't ever remember seeing anything like that when I was little. You know, you have all of these things happening all over the world that shows localities are increasingly being stressed by climate change, but the whole globe is being absolutely pounded by the heavyweight champion of nature, you know, just absolutely pounding, because there's just so much energy in the system that always has to be released, either in heat, either in torrential rainfall, either in drought, taking the water from your soil to produce that torrential rainfall somewhere else, or in these titanic superstorms, you could call them, that tear through areas that never experienced anything like it before.
Last summer, you were featured in a Mother Jones magazine article explaining why the extreme heat is way worse than you think. A new summer is coming in the Northern Hemisphere. Why is extreme heat worse than we realize?
Well, that's extreme heat is quite literally the signature symptom of global warming. And the thing about extreme heat events is that the extreme heat events themselves are both in the land and in the ocean. So, you know, even 20 years ago, I never really heard many people talk about, or 10 years ago even, talk about ocean heat waves. But now it's talked about all the time. This section of the ocean's having a heat wave. Basically, it's, you always had like areas where there might be slightly anomalous heat or such. But in this case, you're getting heat waves in the ocean so extreme that they just wipe out coral everywhere across the planet. And this, we saw this in 2016-17, where there was widespread coral bleaching and fatality of coral across the world. And so obviously that affects hundreds of thousands of species that depend on coral reefs for their very ecosystems and ultimately their survival. Meanwhile, on land, you're having a phenomenon that's really ramped up since the late 80s and into the 90s, where, you know, a lot of people talk about, like, as I mentioned earlier, Arctic amplification of warming that we can suggest for him. You also have land amplification, and that's simply because the land areas, the actual physical landmass, can't retain as much heat as the oceans. So they release their heat back to the air above them, warming the air faster over the land than in the oceans. Obviously, for the oceans, the ocean species, a little bit of warming is potentially lethal. But on land areas, the species, some species can take a little bit more range of warming. But as we've gone on, decade after decade, the past three decades, you've started to get warming events so profound over the land masses that it's starting to kill the wildlife on land. So you have, obviously, 2003 was an extreme event for heat in Europe that actually killed tens of thousands of people. You had extreme heat in Australia that actually killed flying foxes. They literally just fell out of the sky or fell out of trees because it was simply too hot for them. You have kangaroos, you know. I could spend probably a whole show talking about Australia, just how abrupt climate change has pounded the heck out of Australia. I mean, you have kangaroos going into the cities to find water because it's so dry everywhere. And then, you know, here in the U.S., you've had, in the last drought they had that's now ended, at least the short-term drought last year, you had horses, wild horses, dying just in the middle of arid areas because they couldn't find adequate food or water. So these extreme heat events, they become so profound that it moves beyond with what the species can handle. And ultimately, it will get to a point where our crops in the middle of our continents of the world will have greater and greater difficulty being produced. And that's already happening. I mean, we really started to see a lot of that last year in Europe, not so much in the U.S., but in Australia, in Central and South America. There's been increasing drought. The tropics are beginning to become very hot. And obviously in the Arctic, the reason I was reporting on that and was interviewed for that story was because there were 90-degree temperatures being found in northern Siberia near the shore of the Arctic Ocean, which obviously has impacts on the permafrost. I mean, you just have permafrost that just melts. That melts, the land slumps because the permafrost holds the land together. You get mass melting of the permafrost, and it turns into carbon dioxide and methane release. And to have those kind of temperatures up there, even in the middle of summer, that were 40 or 50 degrees above normal Fahrenheit, was a profound, you know, to me, a profound shift in the state of the Arctic. And we really continue to see that with these extreme heat events. Extreme heat is a highly anomalous heat compared to the 20th century. So it doesn't have to be hot for humans. It can be hot for other species or hot for ice. Because as you lose that ice, you lose a crucial source of a heat sink where heat can go into melting and or refreezing the ice when it's released from the water, or reflects light from the sun. So that's sea ice, polar ice at the ice caps, glacial ice in the alpine regions of the world, and obviously the permafrost holds all that organic compounds that can be decomposed by bacteria and potentially turned into carbon dioxide or the very potent greenhouse gas and methane to accelerate global warming even more. So to me, the heat is, besides perhaps the water, the power of water and the floods that are increasing on the planet, is really a kicker for putting the biosphere at risk, because it just has, most of the life on this planet just has certain conditions of which it needs in temperature to survive. And if you're changing those temperatures so rapidly, not over thousands to 10 or 20,000 years like as we did when we came out of the last ice age, but in a matter of years to decades, that's absolutely catastrophic for life forms that need natural selection, evolution, in order to have a chance at adapting to such changes.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Covering the world, this is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
You are tuned to the one and only Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and I'm really pleased to have as my guest American meteorologist Nick Humphrey. We're talking about the gulf between weather reporting and ongoing climate change, but as you can see, Nick is really in depth on all of these issues. Meanwhile, thousands of people had to abandon their homes in Ontario and Quebec, Canada, and that includes the country's capital, Ottawa. But that won't stop the Canadian government in their crazy buyout of a pipeline from the tar sands to Vancouver, or the so-called Canada East Line. It seems, Nick, we just can't stop building fossil fuel infrastructure even as our population gets flooded out or burned out as we were in the West, or just dies in the heat as many, many people are doing. It's phenomenal, isn't it?
Yeah. To me, at this point, the amount of greenhouse gases that we've pumped into the atmosphere and what we've done already as a species, and obviously, you know, some are far more responsible than others, particularly, you know, the developed world and the consuming world. And obviously others in the developing world are trying to catch up to what we've done, which exacerbates it. But there's already been so much done that I don't think there's much of a path to get away from catastrophic climate change. But to me, just to continue to see all of this, even though everyone knows what's already been done and what you do further if you do more, to me, it's grotesque. You know, it's like, you know, giving someone with lung cancer that they got from, you know, smoking cigarettes for 50 years, giving them, you know, well, you're gonna die anyway. Here's another pack of cigs for you. You know, it's kind of like, regardless of whether you view the world as being on a path that cannot be avoided or not, that's my personal opinion on it, you can certainly do things to not add additional damage to your world and to the species of this planet. And it just does not appear that the world's leaders or industry or anybody is particularly interested in doing anything of any consequence. I mean, how many I mean, I always joke around, you know, how many COPs have we had, the climate meetings, you know, since the early 90s, where every year the carbon dioxide concentration continues to go up. It's just, you know, it's mind-boggling. We have COP 22, 23. I mean, I've lost count now, and they're almost seem pointless. Yeah, I look at just this week, they had a meeting of diplomats in Paris. I read about this just today, where they were looking at the indicators for basically the destructive nature of humans on this planet, you know, and to put it mildly, you know, where they were looking at, they had made targets, I believe in 2010, the UN did, on protecting more species, making more protective areas, reducing deforestation on the planet. And most of those goals failed miserably. I mean, they were just blown off the water by the relentless growth of everything. I mean, you grow the economy on your planet, you're going to that the economy is a representation of energy usage on this planet. It's like a thermodynamic engine, and the more growth you have, the more waste you have. So the waste can come in greenhouse gases. It can come in industrial pollution, radiological pollution, plastic pollution, which is everywhere on this planet now, and every person on this planet, essentially. And the exponential growth comes at the expense of all the resources you're literally throwing in the wood chipper to produce that kind of explosive growth that has no end. So even if you slow your population growth, and I know the rate of population growth is still increasing rapidly, but it is slowing compared to the past, your increased consumption, you're still getting the same devastating effect. It may even be worse because you have lots of people in the developing world that, you know, in a social justice perspective, have a right to want to be at some level to what we've had because we took a lot of those resources, we being anybody that's living in the developing world like Britain, United States, Canada, et cetera. But, you know, so many of our predecessors caused so much damage leading up to now, and now folks in the developing world feel they want to join in on the right to a decent living, but it causes further destruction. It's an example of just how unfair the world is, but that unfairness was built decades ago or even hundreds of years ago, leading up to the problems we have today. And it's a really sad state for the world where you open up a news story, not many news stories like this will be on the 6 o'clock news, but you open a news story and you see, oh, a million species could go extinct in the coming few decades. Rainforests are being destroyed at this such and such rate. It's accelerating. And you know that means terrible things for not only the other species on this planet, but for humanity.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
In the news from Manaloa, Hawaii, we learned that the weekly carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere are now hovering around 414 parts per million. It seemed like yesterday it was just around 403 parts, and 414 is literally off the charts. If you make a chart showing CO2 for the last 800,000 years, and Sam Karana at arcticnews.blogspot did that, and you pretty well need to add a whole new page on top just to see our current levels, and that's, as you said, just CO2. It doesn't count the stronger greenhouse gases like methane and nitrous dioxide. And I was interested at truthout.org. Dar Jamal wrote, "The last time there was this much CO2, trees grew at the South Pole." Now, it'll take a long time to get there, but that seems like where we're headed. And so I predict that children born this year in the American South may well end up living in northern Canada if they live at all, and ditto for kids born around the Mediterranean, where millions are already leaving. Do you think I'm being too extreme when I say those things, Nick?
No. I mean, it's... There are others that have had scientists that have had sort of the guts to say something like that. I mean, Dr. Peter Wadhams, Dr. Ira Leifer has actually suggested that you will probably have a few survivors or attempted survivors trying to get up to the Arctic in the Northern Hemisphere. And with, as you mentioned, as I mentioned earlier, with the other greenhouse gases, it's around the equivalent CO2 level is around 500 ppm. I mean, that in paleoclimate world, going back 20, 30 million years, that you would had an average surface temperature of between 4 and 6 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. That, that's going to make much of the U.S. and Europe aridify. They're going to undergo aridification. The Amazon rainforest will just die. Australia will become, it's already becoming incredibly hot in Australia. It's kind of shocking to see just with the climate change that's already occurred, what's happening in Australia. I mean, I keep mentioning Australia, but it just seems so crazy what's been happening there in that region, let alone what happened in my part of the world. But, when you get those kind of temperatures, and the thing is that, although you had trees growing at the South Pole, the thing is, the climate change that occurred naturally was over the course of tens of thousands of years or even longer, many tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of years. It was natural because of just changes in the CO2 level in the atmosphere, what was being retained in the oceans and the rocks versus the atmosphere, natural volcanism, and also the position of the Earth relative to the sun. So long precession of changes. This is basically, we've burned about 200 million years worth of plant growth in about 250 years. Basically, it took 200 million years for plants growing continuously to sequester or store in the ground the carbon that we've released in 250 years, and about 50 million years of that plant growth was released in the last 25 to 30 years. So you're talking about a massive injection of ancient carbon into the atmosphere, and it's causing a level of change and a rate of change that just hasn't been seen in Earth's history. I mean, I that's not really an exaggeration. I mean, it's the only thing I could compare it to that would be faster than this, and it would go on the cold side, of course, would be asteroid impacts. Like 66 million years ago, the asteroid impact that killed the dinosaurs dropped the temperature of the Earth, I think, about 10 to 15 degrees Celsius. Globally in a matter of a few years. This is obviously potentially going the other way, not quite as fast, at least so far, but it's getting to the point where it's getting at a speed that a lot of, particularly the larger life forms, the mammals, the larger reptiles, large life forms cannot adapt fast enough because they just need certain environmental conditions. And so humans, obviously knowing what's happening, or will know, if they don't realize already, yes, you could see massive migrations. But of course, my fear is that, as we already see from the somewhat hostile hostilities toward migrants coming from the Middle East or from North Africa into, say, Europe, into the United States from Central and South America, that as climate change continues to become absolutely devastating, it will become far more devastating, particularly heat and heavy rain events in the tropics, and you're going to have go from thousands to millions and potentially more people retreating north, and they're going to be meeting hostile, Americans, Canadians, Europeans that don't want the crowds of people, because they're going to be concerned about their resources that may be under threat by climate change as well, and then they have to feed and clothe and give water to all these millions of people that are suddenly retreating and basically abandoning these countries. That's call it what it is. That's what's going to happen. You're going to see cities and countries just be abandoned in the tropics. I mean, you can't have temperatures rising to 2 to 3 to 4 degrees in a matter of potentially a few decades and not have stuff like that happen. I mean, it's not going to be pretty. It's going to be ugly. I mean, if you just look at the trends right now in global warming, in sea level rise, basically what most people see in 2075, 2100 looks increasingly likely for 2050, just looking at the trends. And obviously, these new generation models may be starting to suggest explicitly in their calculations the exact same thing. I could easily see, just based on an exponential trend that's already been, exponential trend that's already been occurring in global sea level, you could see over a meter or near a meter of sea level rise by 2050. You know, that could easily happen to me because of the exponential injection of water that's coming in from Greenland and increasingly from Antarctica. And you could see, even if you don't account for all of the methane and other greenhouse gases that may come pouring out at more rapid rates from the permafrost in Siberia and Canada, you could easily see global average temperature of well over 2 to 2.5 degrees by the 2040s, and over the land masses, 3.5 degrees. I mean, that ends up causing devastating impacts to crops, devastating impacts to human health because of extreme heat events and increasing humidity from increasing evaporation, aridification of the land, fires, and obviously the collapse of species, particularly insects, which are already on a path to go extinct in this century, and there may be relatively little of the biomass left even by mid-century. Again, assuming that there aren't these other tipping points that we just hit, we don't notice until they're in the rearview mirror, and then they accelerate things even further. I'm just giving the trends that appear to be going on based on what's happened since the 1990s and 2000s into present. So for me, I mean, it's dire, and I think, you know, people need to be prepared to hopefully have some compassion for people that are going to be coming from areas that are going to fare far worse than us, perhaps in the north, more initially. But even here, you know, anywhere in this part of the world, in Europe, in North America, Asia, we're already facing some significant devastating impacts from climate change that will affect us as things get worse in other places.
Yeah, and it's not just weather and heat and the super storms that we've seen. We've seen these giant cyclones, but also, as you mentioned, sea level rise. And I got the startling news, Jakarta is sinking. Now, it's partly because they've drained out all the groundwater below them and other factors, but it's also rising seas. And that's just one of many sinking cities. Not New Orleans is one, but Lumberton, South Carolina, Italy's Venice, and Rotterdam in the Netherlands. There's a whole thing called the Sinking Cities Project, and the whole coast of New England is kind of sinking due to long-term glacial pressure that isn't there anymore. So I guess my point is, rising seas are not going to be reported first by climatologists. It's going to be reported as weather, as storm surge smashes ashore, as salt water replaces the groundwater. And people like you will probably be on the front lines of that story, too, don't you think?
Yeah. I mean, when I talk about sea level rise being, you know, such and such by the mid-century, and one has to look at the baseline. Where is that baseline from? That baseline is from the early 90s or mid-90s when they started taking satellite measurements. But if you look at tidal gauges, sea level started to, well, the earliest that we've recorded sea level rise is 1880. So since about 1880 till the end of last year, we've already had about a quarter meter of sea level rise. But that's since 1880. So basically, climate change first started to get felt in probably thermal expansion. So you warm the oceans just a little bit and you start to rise them. And also, to a smaller degree, but it's increasing dramatically recently, the melting from Greenland and Antarctica. But some of these processes started in the late 19th century. So you could literally go to a place in, say, Florida or Louisiana or Bangladesh, that was there, that was dry land in 1880, that is no longer dry land anymore. It's under sea level. But beyond that, there were probably areas that did not flood in a storm of a certain intensity in 1880, that by 2000, they got storm surge by the storm of the same strength, because you've raised the mean water level. It now can surge so much farther inland than it could in 1880. And obviously with, say, Louisiana has lost a lot of sediment that would otherwise replace the sediment that's already in the Mississippi Delta because of damming of the Mississippi River. So that's caused part of the wetlands and the Delta to sink. But now increasingly, not only is it sinking by that anthropogenic effect, but you're also getting sea level rise from anthropogenic global warming. So it accelerates the loss of land in Louisiana. So now at this point, you could conceivably get extreme storm surge events that could surge well into parts of Louisiana, because it is simply the whole southern section of Louisiana is just going underwater. You're losing land every single day, every single year to the rising seas, rising, absolute rising, but also relative rise from the sinking of southern Louisiana because of lack of sediment replacement. So it's kind of an interesting phenomenon, because it shows that humanity is suffering the effects of all of its anthropogenic forcing that is applied to try to control everything. You know, we wanted all this energy, we wanted all this power, all this control of the rivers, but now it's basically shooting ourselves in the foot, and a lot of ecosystems that obviously populated those areas, they're going to go underwater when they weren't meant to be completely submerged. And, you know, I see a lot of denial. I hear stories or watch documentaries of people that refuse to leave their homes in Louisiana as the water slowly creeps up on their small little communities. Or I can just watch Miami, where you're building more and more on the coast, you know, mostly rich homes or hotels. Even as the sea level continues to rise, the sea level rises exponential. You're getting storms that by themselves will be more capable of surging onto the land, but they also will become stronger because the oceans are getting hotter. And it's like, for humans, basically, to give up their habitat, and that's what it is, their habitat that they took over from the natural land, basically nature has to wipe that area out and then wipe it out again, and wipe it out to the point to where humans say, with their economics, we can't afford to live there anymore. We have to leave. We have to move on. We can't get drinkable water because of saltwater contamination. Storms are destroying the infrastructure every couple years. We have to leave. That's how it's going to happen. You know, it's not going to be anyone really deciding to just go. In most cases, it's going to be, can I live here? Can I work here? Can I have a life here? And when it's just kind of obvious you're sitting in a bunch of water that ain't going away, you're going to leave. And that's a fact that's already starting to happen here on the plains. I heard last month, actually, that LinkedIn had reported to some news agency that they had noticed a lot of people living in this region that were in flood-prone areas changing their address, meaning they were moving, they were leaving. They lost everything or lost a significant amount, and they just were upping and moving, you know, that fast. And that's literally what it looks like when humanity loses its habitat, loses your home, loses your town. You can't afford to farm in that area anymore. Your farmland's covered in sand. You just decide, oh, man, I can't waste any more time anymore. I got to make the choice, and I got to make a choice to go live with a friend or go move to another city and try to make something and just up and leave. And that's what it looks like. So that's what to me, from the human perspective, and really the perspective of perhaps a lot of species that may have the ability to try to move to escape, that's what it looks like. When it just becomes too bad and you can't survive there, you move on. And that's what it'll look like for humans in the next 10, 20, 30 years.
All right. Well, Nick, we are running out of time. In fact, we are out of time. So you're one of the few trained weather experts who looks at climate change as part of the new reality. How can listeners get your updates, Nick?
Well, I do my more in-depth analyses and write-ups on my Patreon account. That's www.patreon.com/meteorologist Nick Humphrey, one word. And if you like my work or whatever, you can leave a donation. But all of my writing is not behind any sort of paywall. It's all public and free. And I'm also on Facebook under meteorologist Nick Humphrey. You can search for me on Facebook. And I do have a Twitter account. I don't use it as often, but I'm on there at NTH_ M-E-T for Met. So that's where I am on Twitter. So I invite people to come. Just to warn you, I am very blunt about the state of our planet and about where I think we're heading. But I welcome anyone with various perspectives and views on the future to come and discuss. And I post a lot of news stories almost daily on my Facebook page.
Okay, so I'm going to put links to all that in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. And I think it was just fabulous talking with you, Nick, and I hope we can do it again. Keep it up. I'm Alex Smith reporting for Radio EcoShock.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
Meanwhile, barely reported in Western news media, the strongest tropical cyclone in 20 years has hit India and Bangladesh. As we heard from our previous guest, David Keelings, climate change did not cause the cyclone or hurricane. But once it was spinning on the overhot waters of the Bay of Bengal, it drove it to Category 3 strength. Fani has winds over 115 miles an hour or 185 kilometers an hour. Over a million people were evacuated away from the coast, saving countless lives in India, over 2 million in Bangladesh. But the wreckage, whole cities battered, villages wiped out, it's extreme. In some cities, the storm surge reached 13 feet, hitting such low-lying delta areas. The sea invaded. Hundreds of thousands of people were made utterly homeless and destitute in Bhubaneswar, the capital city of Odisha state. Just trying to bring back electricity on India's east coast will cost hundreds of millions of dollars. No one knows when power will be restored. Keep two things in mind. One, there will not be anywhere near enough aid for those affected. Many lives, businesses, and farms will not return. And two, the global emissions for those people is infinitesimal. They did not cause the warming seas that took the cyclone Fani to such extremes. We did. And we will not pay for the restoration, and we will not stop making it worse. I just wanted to squeeze in a bit from a teleconference, May 3rd, 2019, hosted by Dr. Jim Bendel, with guest Carolyn Baker. Carolyn says,
my experience is that so often as we begin to talk about collapse of systems and climate catastrophe, people want to know when. Okay, so when is this going to happen? How long do you think we have? Mm-hmm. And I see this in preoccupation with some of the conversations on Facebook about this. And my philosophy these days is I am really attached to not knowing because I don't know. You don't know. None of us on this call knows when, where, how. And so to stay in that place of not knowing, which is a place of possibility, it's a place of the unexpected, that, you know, it isn't going to unfold exactly as we think or predict. And in that not knowing, I believe, is more potential and more strength than being attached to certainty.
That was Carolyn Baker. Find videos of these free monthly Zoom teleconferences at deepadaptation.info. One of my own interviews with Carolyn was broadcast June 7, 2017. I'll put a link to that and the Jim Bendel YouTube in my EcoShock blog. Check out Carolyn Baker's work at carolynbaker.net. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock again this week, and I hope to connect with you again.
Radio EcoShock.
And if we want to preserve a planet resembling the one that we inherited from our fathers, we're going to need to change the course of our emissions into the atmosphere. And in fact, there are other reasons that it makes sense to do that. And I think we still have time to do that, but unless we begin to make changes this decade, it's going to be very difficult to preserve a planet similar to the one that we inherited.
Global.
next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
Joining us on the Electronic Intifada podcast today is UC Berkeley lecturer Hatem Bazian. He's also the chair of American Muslims for Palestine. Hatem, so good to have you back on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Nora and Asa from UK. So hopefully we'll make that connection work.
So we're speaking about this, these new revelations that have come out about the private Israeli intelligence firm Psy Group, which actually I believe, closed its doors last year. But recently, Adam Entus, the reporter for The New Yorker, who co-wrote a longer article on Psy Group with Ronan Farrow a few weeks ago, he wrote about Psy Group's specific involvement with spying on and intimidating Palestine rights activists in the U.S. For years, we've been following how the Israeli government and its operatives and Israel lobby groups have been spying on and threatening activists, specifically those who support the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement around the world, and especially those who are on college campuses, either as students or members of faculty. The article begins with how in 2017 you went outside your house and found that the windshields on all the cars on the block were plastered with posters that accused you of supporting terrorism. And actually, our former colleague Charlotte Silver wrote about this when it happened in May 2017. The New Yorker article adds that, quote, although it is unclear who left the flyers, internal documents from a private Israeli intelligence firm called Psy Group show that at the time of the incident, the company and possibly other private investigators were targeting Hatem Bazian because of his leadership role in promoting the BDS movement. Hatem, can you talk about what happened and what you know about Psy Group as these revelations have come to light?
Again, going back to the actual incident, on 2017, the whole block was covered, all of the windshields on the cars of my neighbors, my house, up and down were covered. I usually go in the morning to take my daughter to school. And I thought initially it was some type of an advertisement for a movie or maybe a sale for half price pizza or something. But I didn't expect that it would be my image and also an image of Rebecca from Jewish Voice for Peace and being just opposed with one another, saying that it's these are terrorists or supporting terrorism. At the same time, they actually dumped a whole bunch of flyers also on one of the city parking lots off Shattuck, right, Shattuck and University. So similarly, the whole windshields in that area were covered, I guess, maybe to try to say that it's not targeted, but it's random because look at this parking lot that was covered with these flyers. Simultaneously, a week earlier or on the same time period, the campus was covered with posters that had my image, Judith Butler, and a few other third all over the campus in the early morning hours. So as we come in the campus in different entrances, you have these posters that basically, again, calling us terrorists, supporters of Hamas, and targeting SJP. So that was in UC Berkeley, but also similar posters were at San Francisco State University targeting Rabab Abdel Hadi, UCLA with Robin Kelly. So what we see is this was a coordinated campaign that was being unleashed on those individuals that are at least either engaged in PDS or outspoken on the Palestine issue. Again, I have been part of the work on Palestine for the longest period. I did establish SJP at UC Berkeley back in 1992-93. So I can understand, you know, the pushback or the contestation with various Zionist groups, whether it's Hillel or Zionist Organization for America. But this seems to be a different dimension of the work and raises again the issue of this private intelligence, and I put private intelligence group between quotation mark, because as the evidence clearly comes out, that the Psy group is a ex-Mossad agents that have set up a private group to targeted intelligence with the ease of access to the internet and all the new modes of communication, and really navigating the line between privacy and intrusion, as well as intimidation. I think they set up the private group in order to bypass U.S. law, which prohibits foreign intelligence organizations to operate in the United States, and therefore they have to operate under a private company or a front. Now, this is not unique to intelligence services. For anyone that followed U.S. intelligence services, again, I know have hosted Philip Agee, John Stockwell, and a host of other CIA ex-agents that have exposed CIA operations in Latin America and the Middle East, where often a front company will be used. And therefore, if the agent is caught or the campaign or the operation goes haywire, that the country can say that we had nothing to do with it, so it's plausible deniability. So it's actually very clearly that the Psy group is an outfit that was set up with possibly clear communication and directives coming from the Israeli Ministry of Strategic Affairs in order to escalate and to target what they call is hard committed advocates of BDS. And from the document that came out in the New Yorker, it seems that they targeted possibly five to nine campuses, 15 to 20 individuals, with a whole strategic layout of what needs to be undertaken. And I think if you read the 7-page document that was released, you could see that this is clearly an intelligence operation run with navigating between the private and the public sector in relations to Israel, and being domestically unleashed in the United States against BDS activists.
Can you talk about the toll that this took on you personally, this particular campaign of the flyers targeting you at home?
Well, I think anyone, including myself, coming out of your home and finding your neighborhood plastered with your face and image on your cars and your neighbors. And again, immediately, as soon as I saw it, I did not want my daughter to see it, to be scared, fearful. So I actually took the flyers from my car, put it on the side, drove her to school, and came back and actually took as many of the flyers from my neighbor's car without being so obvious that I'm actually taking from their cars. What is this person doing? So that's definitely is a major concern, that now you're not only worried about advocacy of Palestine. I can understand and deal with the politics on campus in a rally or in lecture. It's part of the landscape, the people, what you call standing up, holding sign. That's just the landscape of the political engagement with your wife, your kids that are being targeted. My wife was very, very concerned, and literally we called in immediately, and we installed a security system, a camera system in the house on the next day in order to actually just make sure that the safety and security of the family is taken care of. Now, adding to another dimension, which I think is part of this impact psychologically as well as socially, that it does create this cloud around you on campus and with your colleagues and the university in particular. And my critique of the university has always been that it has a very close relationship and coordination with the pro-Israel forces on campus and off campus. We came to know this during the actual PDS vote that the Berkeley Student Council took. What we found out is that the university chancellor and the dean of students were coordinating their statement on public relations position with the Israeli consulate And we're on a first name basis with the ADL calling and trying to coordinate.
Wow.
So we know that this relations was very close. So in here, a university chancellor coordinating their statements, their action with a foreign government to target or derail or alter the democratic process that are being undertaken on campus relative to the PDS.
Yeah, that's pretty. It's pretty staggering, but
I would say typical.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, for those of us who look at Absolutely. These things, you know, closely or professionally as we do, it is unsurprising, and it happens here too in the UK. I think it's, you mentioned the ADL as well, the Anti-Defamation League, and it's worth mentioning that the ADL for many years ran a massive spy ring on right. in the United States.
Well, I have primary research on that.
Yeah, on behalf of the Israeli government and on behalf of the South African apartheid regime as well, for many years, and you know, this all came, as you know, this all came out. In the late 80s, early 90s. But it's kind of almost forgotten about now. And I think that's an example of what you were talking about earlier, of this kind of trend of privatized intelligence, I suppose. And we'd like to talk about that a bit more. But I think, first of all, could you maybe talk about why do you think... my question to you is, why do you think you in particular were targeted? I mean, you've mentioned your involvement, you know, in establishing Students for Justice in Palestine, you know, many, many years ago. And obviously you're a well-known academic and activist, you know, Palestinian in the US. But why do you think you as the do you think your role as the director of American Muslims for Palestine specifically was a specific target here?
I think there are a number of issues that coalesced together. One, I think the success of the PDS movement on college campuses, and specifically the success of the SJP as a leading advocate for Palestine, has brought my role and my engagement to the forefront. Just to, as a matter of on the record, that I did help create the strategy for how to engage on college campuses relative to SJP and the PDS movement. This came as a result of my involvement in the South Africa anti-apartheid movement. I was on the National Committee for campus organizing at the time as the chair of the National Students of Color Coalition. And we targeted Coca-Cola on college campuses during the anti-apartheid movement. And as the anti-apartheid movement came to a successful conclusion, began to think of how to bring that strategy into Palestine. And this came at this critical moment where the Gulf War resulted in the diminishment or the stop of Palestinians and Arab coming to the U.S. to study because of lack of resources. For those who don't know, many Palestinians or Palestinian families who worked in Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and the Gulf were expelled or out as a result of the Gulf War, which ended up limiting the amount of resources that Palestinian students who want to study abroad had access to. And all of a sudden, after the first Gulf War, 1992-93, you did not have any new Palestinian students coming to campuses, and that also impacted our organizing. So that's where the idea of SJP is to open the broad base coalition in the same way for the South African model of organizing. So that success on college campuses is one factor. The second is also strategically Israel have shifted some of its language post 9/11 to use Islamophobia as the mechanism to try to defame and to tarnish the status and the position of pro-Palestine work and try to label anyone that engages in Palestine work to being an individual that are supporting Islamic terrorism. And you could see that in the initial Luntz report that recommended language usage for pro-Israel spokespeople, Israeli spokespeople, to mirror
And that was the 2009 report by the Israel Project. Is that right?
Actually, much earlier, there was a launch strategy, but it came out, the Israel Project came out with a full report in 2009. So actually, right. As soon as 9/11 took place, by 2001, 2002, there was actually a document of public relations of actually what to say on TV, what to say on radio. That and there you get that the language of saying that the United States have Osama bin Laden, we have Yasser Arafat, we have Hamanistan and Afghanistan. So that language was deployed. And as such, using myself as a target, where I am very active on the SJP front, I'm as active on the AMP front. So that creates a convenient target in there. The third element, which I think possibly not to speak in here, that I don't pigeonhole myself on Palestine. Again, I've been active in a variety of struggles, organized on the South African front, Latin American front, which got me, again, in being a target of the ADL way back, organized for American with Disabilities Act, walked twice to Sacramento from San Francisco, a 92-mile march for public education, supported the United Farm Workers, organized against the war, whether it's in the war in Afghanistan, Iraq. So my engagement is actually very wide, and also led at the statewide campaign against the end of affirmative action, which also got me entangled with the ADL on those issues. So the fact that I work in an intersectionality and work broader coalition that is goes beyond the Palestinian Muslim landscape provide for them a target that needs to be isolated so it does not bleed into what they consider to be the mainstream, which, again, it's an area that I contend with. At a certain point, the ADL actually and JCRC locally put a 5-page hit piece on me to the Democratic Central Committee of San Francisco and Bay Area to see how horrible I am. So, again, this fits into this broader strategy of pushing Muslim Palestinians, pro-Palestinian activists from civil society, so you would not have an impact and engagement to counter the narrative that is taking place. And I think today, as we see the attack on Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, I think it fits the specific strategy. And I actually say that both Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib are subject to the same side group strategy, using all types of mechanism in order to target them. And I would advise them and anyone that is working in that space to actually look at where the funding is coming from, what type of intelligence operations being run at them at this point in order to push them out of civil society and the impact on civil society as we discussing the specificity of the side group in relation to my case.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome. Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who talks about the findings in a new report he co-authored with Jeffrey Sachs on the deadly impact of U.S. sanctions on the Venezuelan people. Wendell Potter, a former health insurance industry executive turned whistleblower, who examines what the nation's insurance industry will be saying and doing to oppose the establishment of a universal single-payer healthcare system in the U.S., such as Medicare for All. And youth climate strike activist Mitchell Kuvidar and Connecticut State Representative Robin Porter, who call for urgent local state action to address climate change. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Four widows of the Ogoni Nine, environmental campaigners who were executed by the Nigerian government in the 1990s, have won the right to press their case against Royal Dutch Shell in a Netherlands court. The ruling now requires Shell to turn over confidential internal documents regarding their dealings with the Nigerian military, which led to the execution of the Ogoni Nine activists, which included award-winning environmental activist Ken Sarowiwa. The case against Shell was originally filed in U.S. courts in 2002, but the U.S. Supreme Court ruled it was filed in the wrong jurisdiction. With the aid of Amnesty International, the widows refiled their case in Dutch courts in The Hague. Shell has long denied any complicity in the deaths of the Ogoni activists or other rights abuses. In 2009, Shell reached an out-of-court settlement for $16 million with the family of Ken Sarowiwa. The case by the Ogoni widows claims Shell was complicit with the Nigerian military's brutal crackdown in the oil-rich Niger Delta, reacting to a grassroots campaign to pressure Shell to clean up their massive oil pollution. During the crackdown, Nigerian security forces were implicated in 50 extrajudicial executions, as well as rape and torture. Liberian environmental lawyer Alfred Brownell won the prestigious Goldman Environmental Prize for defending over 500,000 acres of tropical forests from palm oil developers in one of the planet's 25 most important biodiversity hotspots. In 2010, Liberian President Ellen John Sirleaf signed a lease with Singapore-based Golden Verolium Liberia to produce palm oil. The government leased undeeded land in the Upper Guinean Forest, historically inhabited by indigenous communities who were vulnerable to agro-industrial and mining projects. In the process, GVL destroyed farmland and polluted fresh water supplies. Local protests quickly broke out against GVL's activities. Brownell, executive director of Green Advocates in Liberia, worked with indigenous leaders to block certification of GVL's Liberia project by the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil. Without the Roundtable's certification of its plantations, GVL could not sell their palm oil to major buyers like Unilever or Cargill. In July 2018, the Roundtable upheld its initial stop work order against GVL. Brownell's efforts prevented the deforestation of more than 500,000 acres of land that sequesters carbon and shelters endangered species. But due to death threats in Liberia, Brownell and his family have been forced to seek asylum in the U.S. As President Donald Trump seeks $4.5 billion in new funding to deal with the spike of asylum seekers turning themselves in at the U.S.-Mexico border, thousands of family detention beds remain empty. Despite this surplus of beds, the Department of Homeland Security insists it needs to build more facilities to house migrants arriving from Central America. The 96-bed Burks facility near Reading, Pennsylvania, for example, is now only at 25% capacity. According to data from ICE, the facility currently houses six families. Its population fell dramatically in late 2018 as the flood of asylum seekers from Central America dramatically increased. According to the American Prospect, there is similar surplus capacity at large facilities in Texas. Immigration attorney Karen Hoffman of ALDEA, the People's Justice Center, says that while we don't think families should be detained at all, we do find it striking that the administration is claiming the U.S. is at capacity when these facilities sit almost empty. She concludes that it wouldn't be far-fetched to assume ICE is trying to exaggerate the extent of the crisis. It's clear that the Department of Homeland Security has made a conscious decision to push hard to boost detention capacity over the option of expanding low-cost supervised family release programs. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
Over the last several months, the Trump administration, through Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Special Envoy Elliot Abrams, have been working quite openly to overthrow the government of Venezuela's socialist president Nicolas Maduro. The latest attempt to oust Maduro came on April 30th, when U.S.-backed self-declared President Juan Guaido called for the Venezuelan military to revolt and participate in a coup. But that effort in the glare of world media failed. In recent years, Venezuela, gripped by economic collapse, has seen some 3 million of its citizens flee the country. The nation's economic crisis can be traced to several important factors, including a dramatic fall in the price of oil, Venezuela's number one export, government mismanagement, charges of corruption, and the imposition of harsh U.S. economic sanctions. The impact of these sanctions is the subject of a new report from the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. The report, titled Economic Sanctions as Collective Punishment, The Case of Venezuela, finds that U.S. sanctions have inflicted deprivation of medicines and food that has resulted in an estimated 40,000 deaths between 2017 and 18. Your reporter spoke with Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and co-author of the report, along with economist Jeffrey Sachs. Here he outlines the findings of the report that looked into the deadly impact of U.S. sanctions on the Venezuelan people.
Yes, it's tens of thousands since August of 2017, when the Trump administration imposed broader financial sanctions that deprived the economy of credit. So we estimated more than 40,000 deaths from 2017 to 2018. Of course, it's very approximate. You can't know exactly how many, but it was based on the increase in mortality from 2017 to 2018. But it's a terrible thing. You know, it's very obvious. There are some people try to deny it because, you know, there are all kinds of people here who support these sanctions. In fact, anybody like Nancy Pelosi and other members of Congress who recognized a parallel government, that is, they recognized Juan Guaido as the so-called interim president when he declared himself president of Venezuela in January. That by itself imposes a whole set of sanctions in addition to Trump's executive orders, because what happens when this government recognizes a parallel government, which, by the way, is something they haven't done since, you know, the Nazis invaded countries in like France and Europe, and the U.S. recognize the government in exile. This is a very unusual, unprecedented thing to say, oh, we don't like the way your election was run in May of 2018, and then almost a year later you come back and say, oh, and by the way, since we didn't like that election and it was disputed, we're going to recognize this guy who our Vice President Pence called the night before and, you know, gave him the go-ahead to declare that he was president, somebody who, you know, hardly anyone in the country knew who he was before he did that. And so this is an extreme measure, but what it does that most people don't know, it creates this whole new set of sanctions, because any money that the sale of oil from Venezuela, which is the way they get almost all of their dollars, any money from that now goes to him instead of to the government, which means that both the government and the private sector are deprived of the money, the foreign exchange, the dollars that are necessary to import food and medicine and medical equipment and everything that hospitals need, and infrastructure for parts for water and sanitation. So that's why the main reason why you see this big increase in deaths. These kinds of sanctions have always been a war. They're like the wars of the Middle Ages, when you lay siege to a city and starve people. Amazingly, our Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, was asked by Matt Lee, the reporter for the Associated Press, at a press briefing on March 11th. He asked him how this regime change effort was going, because clearly that was already 3 months since they first declared the presidency of Juan Guaido. And so Matt Lee said, "Are you satisfied with the pace of the momentum behind Guaido and his leadership?" And Pompeo said, this is his answer, and I'm reading it from the transcript of the press conference. He said, "Well, we wish things could go faster, but I'm very confident that the tide is moving in the direction of the Venezuelan people and will continue to do so. It doesn't take much for you to see what's really going on here. The circle is tightening. The humanitarian crisis is increasing by the hour. You can see the increasing pain and suffering that the Venezuelan people are suffering from." So you see, he's basically telling them that this is what's going to overthrow the government. And it hasn't succeeded yet, but that's their actual strategy. These tens of thousands of people are not even collateral damage, you know, like in a bombing. They're actually the point of the sanctions, so that people will become desperate, either topple the government or the military will be convinced to topple the government, which is what they tried to do just a week ago.
What do you make of calls for dialogue and negotiations to end both the political and economic crisis in Venezuela, where the United Nations and the Vatican have offered to be mediators in such talks, in an effort to avert more pain and suffering and to avoid a future threatened Trump administration military intervention, or the possibility of proxy forces going to civil war, where certainly many more lives will be lost?
They said from the beginning they don't want any mediation. They don't want any kind of negotiation, because as soon as the Vatican announced it, they were willing to mediate if asked by both parties. Trump said no, and then Pompeo said no. The time for negotiations has passed. What they're really doing there is trying to avoid any kind of negotiated solution. And they're doing that by choosing Juan Guaido. He's with a party called Voluntad Popular, which has just 14 seats out of 167 in the National Assembly. And why did they choose him and his party? Because they don't want any kind of negotiation. Whereas probably most of the opposition would like to negotiate, or at least a good part of it, a much larger part than he represents.
That was Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., and co-author of the report titled "Economic Sanctions as Collective Punishment, The Case of Venezuela." Find a link to the report and additional analysis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Democratic Party-controlled House of Representatives took its first historic step on April 30th to begin a national debate on the popular proposal to establish a Medicare for All universal health care system in the U.S. The hearing before the House Rules Committee focused on a bill recently introduced by Representative Pramila Jayapal, Democrat of Washington, called the Medicare for All Act of 2019, that would cover all Americans' health care needs and transition the nation to the program over the course of 2 years. One of the most impassioned speakers supporting Medicare for All at the hearing was Adie Barkin, a veteran health care activist who suffers from the degenerative neural disease, ALS, who used a computer to assist him to address the legislators. Your reporter spoke with Wendell Potter, a former health insurance industry executive turned whistleblower and author. Here he examines what the nation's insurance industry will be saying and doing to stop the momentum of the movement supporting a transition to a universal single-payer healthcare system in the U.S., such as Medicare for All.
Well, it was a very, very historic hearing in that there never has been a hearing ever before in Congress on moving to a Medicare for All type of healthcare system. In fact, just 10 years ago, during the debate on what became the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, as most people call it, no one from any single-payer organization was even given any serious consideration. In fact, at one point, during a hearing at the Senate Finance Committee, some supporters for single-payer health care were actually ejected from the hearing room and arrested because they were raising a ruckus, primarily because no one was paying attention to the efforts to try to move us to a Medicare for All type of health care system. Things have changed so much in those 10 years. More people are realizing that the Affordable Care Act, even though it did significant good, doesn't go nearly far enough to get us closer to universal coverage or control health care costs.
Wendell, on the insurance industry side, they are making claims that Medicare for All will drive taxes higher, that Americans will have less choice, longer waiting times for doctors and operations, lower quality, and there will be rationing of care. And of course, there are single-payer universal health care systems all across the developed world. In fact, the United States is the only country not to have a universal system. But tell us a bit about how you, as an insurance industry insider, responds to these arguments, which are, I think, really the boilerplate of how the insurance companies are going to try to derail efforts to move Medicare for All forward.
Well, they're using the same tactics they've used for decades to push back against any kind of reform that the industry doesn't like and that the industry feels might threaten profits, because at the end of the day, it's all for them about profits, about making money for shareholders. So they engage in what I've often referred to and what we referred to in the PR business as FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt. And all of these campaigns are based on lies and half-truths. That's one of the things I write a great deal about, is to help people understand that this is just all made-up stuff. Let's take them one by one. We're talking about a system that would be publicly financed but privately delivered. And, of course, you have taxpayers who would provide the funding for that. But what they obscure, what they don't tell you, is that the money will come from shifting premiums, money we pay into private insurance companies, into a single fund that will be administered much more efficiently. They talk about rationing. We have the most insidious form of rationing in the developed world. We ration on the ability to pay. Let's talk also about the choice issue. They maintain that this would take away choice. That is obscuring the reality of a current system in which insurance companies, our employers, are limiting our choices. It's not choice of health insurance plans that Americans are interested in. They want to have choice of doctors and hospitals. And increasingly, insurance companies are limiting our choices through these narrow networks that are features of almost all the health plans we have these days. So, in other words, they seek to mislead and obscure, and they lie, plain and simple.
Wendell Potter, are you optimistic that public pressure and aggressive legislators can move the ball forward on Medicare for All? Or do you think with all their money and all their influence, the insurance industry will win this fight?
I'm optimistic. And if I didn't think that it was winnable, I wouldn't be in this fight myself. I think it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when we have a Medicare for All type of healthcare system, because the current system is failing more and more of us every year. We're seeing that our employer-based system is crumbling, and it's just a matter of time before it collapses.
That was Wendell Potter, a former health insurance industry executive turned whistleblower and author, who's founder of the investigative news platform Tarbell.org. Find a link to Potter's recent article titled "Propaganda Machine Stalls at Medicare for All Hearing" by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Students across the U.S. and world held a second youth strike for climate on May 3rd. In Connecticut, young and older activists convened outside the Capitol building in Hartford, where in addition to listening to short speeches, attendees had a chance to take a recycling quiz, make posters, and share their thoughts about the climate crisis. Then the students, mostly high schoolers and their adult supporters, participated in a press conference to add their voices to those of lawmakers and activists, promoting a number of environmental and climate bills in this year's legislative session. At the top of the list was an effort to roll back at least some of the legislature's reduction of funds that are collected on ratepayers' electric bills, explicitly to fund energy efficiency measures. $155 million was removed from this fund in 2017 in order to balance the state budget, and about half is already gone. However, the next installment is due to be taken in June of this year, unless the General Assembly votes not to. The state government won an initial lawsuit challenging what opponents charged was theft of these funds, and the case is now being appealed. One of the speakers was Mitchell Kuvidar, a Connecticut youth climate leader. Also speaking was Connecticut State Representative Robin Porter, who represents a low-income community in New Haven, where many residents suffer from the negative health effects of the burning of fossil fuels. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended the Youth Climate Strike rally and press conference and brings us the following excerpts of their comments.
The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change states that we only have 12 years to drastically alter every aspect of our society and our economy. Every aspect must change to support a healthy path forward for everyone. This will be no easy task. No one says it will be, but it needs to be done. I'm a 19-year-old college student. Right now, I'm supposed to be studying for my pre-calc final. I'm here today because I think this is far more important. This is the most important issue of our time. The effects from unabated climate change will be devastating for both Connecticut and the entire world. We risk drastic sea level and flooding, billions to the economy, an uptick in deadly wildfires and droughts, the complete melting of the Arctic, and potentially a sixth mass extinction on both our land and seas, and economic and societal ruin as a result. As the communication director of the College Democrats for the state, the co-communications director for the Sunrise Movement here in Connecticut, and as a co-lead for the Connecticut Climate Strikes, I, for one, can tell you that this issue is one that the youth recognize as our greatest threat. Now, we expect all of you, our politicians and leaders, to recognize both our voices in this discussion and to listen to the science and act accordingly, because ignorance will not do any of us any favors. Ignorance will not win a re-election. Ignorance will not buy us time. Ignorance will make us replace you. The easiest way the state can make progress in the effort to fight climate change is through energy efficiency and reduction, and it comes with some great side effects. The Conservation and Load Management Plan is part of this answer, yet the state keeps pulling funds from it and plans to once again this June. An effort to stop climate change, energy conservation and energy efficiency is our easiest and most effective way to eliminate greenhouse gas production. It is this simple. The less energy a building uses, the less power it needs, and the less fossil fuels that will need to be burned, regardless of where the power is coming from. With 10 years of investment, Connecticut has avoided building two new power plants, removed 11.4 million tons of carbon from our atmosphere. Now, this means cleaner air. Cleaner air in a state that was just rated by the American Lung Association as having one of the highest asthma rates in this country. This is a public health crisis and a drain on our already strained health services. Efficiency has the incredible ability to lower expenses for residents, draw less energy from the grid, cut pollution, and strengthen our local green jobs. I myself come from a low-income household where my single mom continuously struggles to pay for electricity bill at the end of the month, and sacrifices are made. But it's not just me. The state has a huge number of residents that are unable to afford their energy bills. Over 400,000 residents cannot afford their energy bills, and that's because this state has the third highest energy cost per capita, and that's growing. Yet, when the Conservation and Load Management Plan was rated, it took away the ability to weatherize 13,000 homes, disproportionately hurting our low-income and underrepresented communities. Thousands of families, needlessly, have high energy bills because we took those funds away. And speaking from firsthand experience, no one, no mother or father, should have to choose to either skip their energy bill or send their son or daughter on a field trip or another school experience. No mother or father should have to sacrifice their own well-being in an attempt to try to do it all. And that is why I believe it should be among the first to take swift and decisive action against climate change, and energy efficiency should be a key part of that.
State Representative Robin Porter also spoke.
I was told the other day a story about a woman, an elderly woman, who had had her services turned off for electricity, and she needed $700 to turn it back on. But in addition to that, she needed over $500 for a reconnect fee. Where was she supposed to get that when she couldn't afford to pay the electric bill in the first place? These are real life issues. These are real life stories that are impacting people on a daily basis. And no one should have to choose between eating and keeping their lights on or keeping their gas on. That they're sitting up in their homes in the wintertime, you know, and they're not warm. Or in the summertime, you go in and it's just too hot. You can barely breathe. And the asthma and all these other things that are impacted, allergies. We have to care. We have to take action. And as has been said, as lawmakers, it is our responsibility to hold our own feet to the fire and make sure we get this done and get some of it done this year. Thank you.
That was Connecticut State Representative Robin Porter, preceded by youth climate leader Mitchell Kovidar, speaking at a May 3rd press conference following a youth climate strike rally at Connecticut State Capitol in Hartford. Learn more about the youth climate strike and local efforts to address climate change by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on Radio Helsinki in Graz, Austria, KRBX in Boise, Idaho, KYAQ in Toledo, Oregon, and dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
The power of movements. When people join together, their power is multiplied. This simple fact has animated every popular movement in Black American history. That means the only time Black folks in America have made a step forward, there was a movement behind it. That's because movements break new ground. Movements open doors that have been locked shut for generations. For movements open hearts and minds. Movements transform people from individuals into parts of a collective. Movements make history. Movements bring change. In fact, it is only movements that bring change. For movements are a social force, a site where many demand the few in power to change and keep pace with the times. Movements work. Movements matter. They change minds, mores, and consciousness itself. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. John Singleton, the well-known writer and filmmaker, who directed the film Boys in the Hood, 1991, was a master of his craft. Boys in the Hood, nominated for an Oscar, gave a sympathetic portrayal of working-class black life. It showed how gang culture had permeated urban spaces. On April 17th, Singleton, recently returned from Costa Rica, reported feeling ill and checked into a local hospital. According to his family, the director had suffered a mild stroke. Days later, Singleton experienced a coma, and several weeks thereafter, the 51-year-old filmmaker was gone. In Boys in the Hood, Singleton presented characters who voiced black concerns. Consider the following dialogue from a character named Furious. "Well, how do you think the crack rock got into the country? We didn't own any planes. We don't own any ships. We're not the people who are flying and floating that blank into here. I know every time you turn on the TV, that's what you see. Black people selling the rock, pushing the rock. Yeah, I know. But that wasn't a problem until it was in Iowa and started up on Wall Street, where there are hardly any black people." Dialogue from John Singleton's Boys in the Hood, 1991. John Singleton has returned to his ancestors. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Nation. It has been decades since two schoolboys in Colorado unleashed deadly havoc on a school called Columbine in what justly seems a lifetime ago. Columbine, which shocked the nation when it happened in 1999, has since receded into a red river of blood and memory. Today, 20 years hence, school shootings have become so common in America that it only fleetingly makes news. It is, sad to say, a yawner. What is also is, it's a window into the troubling minds of young Americans. They live their lives of youth in a kind of emptiness, unfeelingness, and they express this alienation with havoc, rage, at loss of tomorrows. They see no hope in this country, no future. And they also do so at a time when politicians have no idea of how to answer this threat to American youth. After children were slain in New England and teenagers were killed in Florida, no solution seems on the horizon. America, which wants to order other countries around, has no real idea how to keep schools safe for their own children in their own land. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
What are the risks associated with the rollout of a new generation of wireless networks? Why are Canadian, American, and world health authorities failing to act on scientific studies pointing to health risks posed by radiofrequency radiation? What kinds of pushback is being faced by citizen groups looking to prevent involuntary exposure to RF radiation? Does the common man and woman stand a chance of frustrating the plans of the big telecom companies? On this week's Global Research NewsHour radio broadcast, in the lead-up to a national day of action against 5G, we take a look at the hype surrounding this fifth generation of mobile communication networks and the potential for harm they pose to the public. In our first half hour, we'll get a breakdown by Meg Sears, a Canadian scientist and chair of the group Prevent Cancer Now, of the known health hazards associated with wireless radiation. We'll hear from Patty Wood of the nonprofit information hub Grassroots Environment Education about efforts to protect the public from the 5G rollout. We'll also hear some comments from Victoria-based activist Walt McGuinness, who is involved in successful efforts to reverse the imposition of the so-called smart meter on people in British Columbia. On this week's program, the 5G revolution, human guinea pigs in big telecom's global experiment. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of May 10th, 2019. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabeg Akin, the homeland of the Métis and the historical territory of the Nahiowak and the Nakota. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. After the worst fighting seen in Gaza since the war in 2014, at least 25 Palestinians, including two pregnant women and a 14-month-old baby girl, have been killed in the past 3 days, while four Israelis were killed by rocket fire from Gaza. The violence started on Friday when the Israeli military and the militant group Islamic Jihad traded fire. Over the next 2 days, hundreds of rockets were launched into Israel from Gaza, with the Israeli military pounding the besieged enclave with airstrikes and artillery. The fierce back and forth threatened to spill over into an all-out protracted war, but by early Monday, a ceasefire was reached between Israel and Palestinian factions. Those killed included one of the best English teachers in Gaza, two fathers of four, one an Israeli and the other a Palestinian, a man riding his bike and another at work, and a 12-year-old at home with his parents. That comes from the article named "The People Killed in Gaza and Israel This Weekend," posted May 7th, originally published at Middle East Eye. Continuing to try to advance the U.S. narrative that Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido is the quote-unquote duly elected president, CNN went to the trouble on Sunday afternoon of inventing an entire election to base this around. In the CNN report, they declared, quote, "Pressure is mounting on Maduro to step down following elections in January in which voters chose opposition leader Juan Guaido over him for president," unquote. There was no election in January. In reality, Venezuela's presidential election was held on May 20th, 2018. The opposition boycotted the vote. Maduro won with 67.8% of the vote, while Guaido did not participate at all. That comes from the article, "Sloppy Journalism. CNN Falsely Claims Venezuela's Guaido Was Elected President in January," by Jason Ditz, posted May 7th, originally published at antiwar.com. As Mint Press and other outlets have previously noted, even the U.S. government's own documents admit that the Houthis in Yemen are not a proxy of Iran and that Iran has no direction over their military actions. In addition, Pompeo's claim that any actions taken by any quote-unquote Shia militia group will be blamed on Iran shows that
the Trump administration is now building a foundation to attack Iran for actions that include those over which Iran has no control whatsoever. Furthermore, given the vagueness of the press release, military action may not even be necessary to trigger a response, as the press release says that, quote, any attack on United States interests or on those of our allies will be met with unrelenting force, unquote. For instance, if Iran makes good on its promise to blockade the Persian Gulf in response to U.S. efforts to place a total embargo on its oil efforts, such a move could now be interpreted as an attack on U.S. interests or those of its regional allies, even though it would not expressly involve an offensive attack. In addition, given that the Trump administration also considers Hamas, which governs the Gaza Strip, a proxy of Iran, future hostilities between Hamas and Israel, the U.S. main ally in the region, could also be interpreted as an attack on the U.S. or allied, i.e. Israeli, interests launched by an alleged Iranian proxy. That comes from the article, Bolton's vague press release lays foundation for military attack against Iran, by Whitney Webb, posted May 7th, originally published at Mint Press News. In summer 2017, there was a dramatic split among Gulf Arab countries, with Saudi Arabia declaring an embargo against Qatar for its support of terrorism. In reality, the move was aimed at cutting growing back-channel talks between Qatar and Iran, both of whom share the world's largest natural gas field in the Persian Gulf. The Qatari section is called North Field, and its LNG is said to be the world's cheapest to extract, making Qatar in recent years the largest LNG exporter. The adjoining Iran section is called South Pars. After spending a reported $3 billion financing anti-Assad and anti-Iran terrorist groups in Syria in a futile try to get a pipeline through Syria to Turkey and onto the huge EU gas market, it seems that the shifty Qataris, at some point after Russia's decisive entry into the Syria war in late 2015, realized it might gain more by shifting sides and covertly working with Iran and Assad and Erdogan to bring both Qatari and Iran gas to market. That comes from the article, Ever More Complex EU Gas Pipeline Geopolitics, by F. William Engdahl, posted May 6th, originally published at New Eastern Outlook. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. The world is on the cusp of achieving a revolution in the way we connect with each other and the world's information resources. Welcome to the 5G revolution, ushered in by telecommunications giants like Verizon, AT&T, and Sprint. The faster communications and larger bandwidth will not only enable faster and more reliable cellular and internet communications, including improved streaming and downloading of high-definition videos, the new generation of wireless communications will usher in innovations thus far relegated to the realm of science fiction scenarios. These include seamless virtual reality videos, efficient smart cities, and an Internet of Things with the potential to link driverless cars, robots, and other sensor-equipped products, as well as phones and computers. Artificial intelligence will be incorporated so as to place a lot of tedious duties out of the hands of humans and into entities acting autonomously. For example, smart homes able to order more eggs, milk, and cheese on their own via wireless connection with a supplier. This new generation of wireless technology involves the use of higher frequency radiation, requiring the construction of millions of mini mobile phone masts in urban centers around the globe. These broadband services will be assisted by orbiting satellites beaming microwave radiation in the 12 to 30 gigahertz range, leaving no corner of the globe uncontaminated by radiation. The promise of this technological wonderland is coming at a price, however, and has some health advocates concerned that an astronomical price will be paid for these marvels, not only in dollars and cents, but in human lives.
To get a closer look at this downside, the Global Research NewsHour reached out to a Canadian expert who has raised concerns about cancer as well as other risks associated with wireless networks.
The group Prevent Cancer Now defines its mission as building a Canada-wide movement to eliminate the preventable contributors to cancer through research, awareness, education, and advocacy. Meg Sears is the chair of Prevent Cancer Now. Meg was trained in chemical engineering and applied chemistry at the University of Toronto, completed a doctorate in biochemical engineering at McGill University, and has diverse laboratory experience, including in energy research. Her achievements include writing the medical perspective on environmental sensitivities for the Canadian Human Rights Commission, leading to a policy under the Canadian Human Rights Act, conducting a scoping review on toxic elements with Canadian Institutes for Health Research and Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council funding, and numerous collaborations with members of the Environmental Health Committee of the Ontario College of Family Physicians and prominent Canadian environmental health and legal groups. Meg Sears joins us now from Ottawa. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Sears.
Oh, my pleasure. I'm glad to be able to do this.
Now, could you share a little bit more about your personal background that's granted you some insights into the risks posed by RF radiation?
Well, radiofrequency radiation has been under the epidemiological microscope for quite a few years. Way back when radar first was being invented and used, it was examined for its health impacts and recognized that certainly the radar workers did have some health effects. And since it's been used for telecommunications over several decades now, it has gained a lot of attention. It's been examined particularly in the context of brain tumors associated with cell phone use. But we now realize that this radiation itself has long been used, actually, in my first endeavors in chemical engineering. I had first heard about radiofrequency radiation called microwave radiation in the summers when I worked at chemical engineering at U of T. Somebody was saying, you know, instead of heating up a pot to basically cook or to conduct a chemical reaction, you can use much less energy if you just use a bit of microwave. And I thought at the time, well, all microwave does is heat, and so how can you get away with less energy when you need more energy? And it turns out that now there is a lot of evidence, and in fact people have commercialized using very low amounts of radiofrequency radiation to do what you would otherwise have to use a lot of energy in basic heating to accomplish. So this radiofrequency radiation actually can accelerate, or what we call catalyze, chemical reactions.
So this is a standard practice in the industry?
This is well known in industry. It's used in industry. It's commercialized. People are making money because radiofrequency radiation or microwave radiation, which are synonymous, microwave is a subset, will actually accelerate chemical reactions without a huge amount of heating. Now, when Health Canada, another whole section, looked at the possible health effects of microwave radiation as when it's used for telecommunications, it was concluded by Health Canada decades ago that the only kind of adverse effect that might come from use of this kind of technology results from heating of the tissue. So when it comes to cell phones, Health Canada says the only possible bad effect can be heating, whereas we have commercialization of processes that cause biochemical effects without a lot of heating.
Mm.
And that's essentially how our body works. It's, you know, we're a big chemical part of biochemistry happening along with electrochemistry. So if it can happen in a laboratory, if it can happen in a chemical reactor, if you can make money because it works so well, how come this radiation can't have biological effects? Well, of course it does have biological effects.
Based on your research, could you maybe take us through some of the known health hazards associated with the cell phones and the current state of wireless technology in its common usage. Well, what are some of the maybe the more pronounced and virtually undebatable aspects?
Well, at very low levels in laboratory studies, we see things like oxidative stress and DNA damage, and in cell cultures and in animals. In animals, we also see effects on development, and we see tumors promoted. In people, the easiest, most obvious kind of study has been to look at brain tumors associated with radio frequency radiation. So in 2011, the International Agency for Research on Cancer, which is associated with the World Health Organization, concluded on the basis of the evidence then that cell phone radiation may or possibly causes human cancer. Since then, we've had two large animal studies come out. We've had additional information on human studies. And so if such a panel were to be reconvened today, experts who actually participated in the previous process are quite convinced that today it would be concluded that cell phones do cause brain cancer. And we also see that in experiments with people and with animals and in samples of semen, that sperm are very severely affected. So the sperm quantities have been crashing across the world for the last few decades. And it's quite possible there are some chemicals involved as well, but there's very good evidence that sperm are adversely affected by cell phones in pockets and laptops on laps.
What are the additional hazards associated with 5G that the scientific literature is pointing to with regard to the exposure, the anticipated exposure?
We don't have very much research at all on the specific health effects of the 5G-associated higher frequency wavelengths. There's actually amazingly little information on that because it hasn't been a practical type of radiation to use, and it still is really not all that practical. We do have better alternatives. So on that part of it, we are kind of flying blind. It's absorbed by the surface of the skin, so there is speculation that it may increase melanoma. It can be dangerous to eyes, although it's relatively easy also to protect yourself against this. But it's really hard to know what the health effects of that particular radiation is. However, 5G is going to require much higher levels of all of the types of radiation that we're already being exposed to. So this 5G is kind of a big, quick data pipe. But in order to use it in a building, we're going to have to be using the frequencies that we're already using.
As a body that encourages that talks about prevention as a means of mitigating the blight of cancer, I'm guessing that your group would be advocating for embracing the precautionary principle, and yet we're seeing this technology just rolling out, and what, they're just going to wait for stuff to happen before they take action? I mean, what is the
for Prevent Cancer Now, we have worked very hard to minimize the exposures to a lot of things, chemicals and radiation, that may promote cancers. And cancer is not a single germ kind of thing. It's kind of a constellation of exposures that would predispose to development of cancer. So we certainly say that we should, look before we leave. We should be precautionary. And one of the most important things we say is that we should be using least toxic practices. So we have established technology already that is extremely fast, extremely high bandwidth, much more secure than 5G ever will be because we're broadcasting all of our personal information throughout the atmosphere. And that is simply to be using a lot more wires and fiber. Out in the, across Canada, there are huge swaths of land and communities that have no access to fiber. I cannot get fiber or cable in my house because I live on the outskirts of the capital of Canada. I don't live right downtown. So there is an alternative, and that's really what we promote, is to say we have this banquet of alternatives. We should be very picky about what we use. And the other issue with 5G is it actually requires a huge amount of greenhouse gases, a huge amount of energy in order to operate, whereas you can transmit the same amount of information using much less energy, much more efficiently, without a huge infrastructure using exotic materials in these antennae and so on, simply with what we already know.
So the increased energy usage, is there studies or agreed upon statistics with regard to how much more energy is going to be used once this 5G internet and the Internet of Things is in place?
It's not well defined because the actual scope and what will happen in the future is not well defined. Nevertheless, there have been studies put forward comparing, the amount of information, the accessibility, and so on, the speed between using fiber and using 5G. Hmm. 5G is also supposed to be used for things like driverless cars and so on. And that's, very much down the road, very much, very experimental.
Yeah, well, part of the appeal with the driverless cars is that's supposed to reduce our, it's supposed to be more efficient, that, eliminate some of the inefficiencies that might come from human decision-making. So,
well, there's certainly a lot of other alternatives in terms of public transit. Yeah. Nevertheless, if we are going to be using much higher amounts of radio frequency radiation and creating a lot more greenhouse gases, simply so you can know the number of eggs in your refrigerator because you can't quite decide whether you should be buying them when you're at the store and your phone has to check. There's a lot of very frivolous things that are being put forward. They're saying we need it for virtual reality. Well, virtual reality experiences can be downloaded and then run. There's a lot of other ways to accomplish the things that we're being told 5G is needed for.
Children are somewhat uniquely vulnerable to exposure, and it seems like current industry practice isn't really doing enough to protect children or warn children and their guardians about the impacts even of the existing technology. Is that right?
Well, there are pediatricians groups. The American Academy of Pediatricians has put forward a statement. Pediatricians are really paying a lot of attention to the amount of screen time that children are using. There's no doubt that that is affecting their development. There's considerable evidence regarding exposure to cell phones and cell phone radiation in utero and very early in development on subsequent behavioral problems in children and brain development. Now, it's hard to tease out how much of that is because of the radiation, although there is animal studies showing that. Animals are not affected by their mother's cell phone use. But in people, it is hard to say, well, the mother's not paying attention to the children, and that's the source of the problem, versus changes in the child's brain chemistry as a result of radio frequency radiation. It's probably a combination of both. Mm. But children are more vulnerable. They're developing. Their brain is not protected as well from radio frequency radiation. And in fact, the very aggressive brain tumors, we have no data from Canada, but in the States, in adolescents and very young adults, the very aggressive brain tumors have been going up very, very quickly, so that we now have more brain tumors, then we have leukemia and testicular cancer, which were more, which were the leading causes of cancer in that age group in the States.
Hmm. Now, my understanding is that no international health authority has done a rigorous scientific review of all the issues related to wireless radiation. The IARC, as you pointed out, did a thorough review in 2011, given with the available cancer data, but this information is yet to be updated. So with all the effort going into building this 5G infrastructure without applying the precautionary principle, in your experience, is this a common practice in other areas, or are we making a special exception just for the wire industry?
Oh, we, particularly in Canada, we have been entranced with promises of wonderful things in the chemicals world. So in Canada, we have bad health outcomes, and we have environmental problems as a result of chemicals that we permitted and then subsequently decided were not very good. And so we have flame retardants in polar bears and in fish that are affecting child development in northern Canada. We have materials in fish in Newfoundland that are affecting people in Newfoundland. So in the chemicals world, we have seen cycles where a pesticide or a flame retardant or an anti-stick chemical was seen to be wonderful, and it took decades, literally, in order to prove that these were causing harm to the environment, causing harm to Canadians, and eventually to ban them. So this is a long, long history that is also playing out in the radio frequency world. Now, the difference between that and the chemicals world is that generally they come up with another solution, another chemical that sometimes looks almost the same, but it's going to be much safer. So we've got this treadmill of one chemical after another. Now, it's going to be a little bit more difficult to come up with a different frequency. This is basic physics, so we can expect to see other sorts of radiation proposed. Right now, they're saying, well, the 5G radiation is a lot safer because it doesn't penetrate as deeply into the body. That also means that the absorption is concentrated in the skin, so perhaps there is an extra risk associated with more concentrated absorption. But it's basically we've been going from the devil we know to the devil we don't, and we eventually figure out the devil we don't know, and we get to know him is really a devil as well.
Well, Dr. Sears, I really want to thank you for acquainting our listenership with some of the underreported medical risks associated with this exciting new technology, and I hope we can speak again, because there's certainly a lot of other issues related to, you know, technology and cancer risks that I think you'd be a very important resource for us to get hold of. So,
oh, I'd be more than happy, and I think throughout life, if we can opt for the least toxic options, which is what our group says we have to do, in order to solve our environmental problems, our health problems, we've really got to switch our decision-making from, you know, post-precautionary to best practices.
Meg Sears, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
We've been speaking with Meg Sears. She's the chair of Prevent Cancer Now. You can find more about her group's work at the site preventcancernow.ca.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. In the United States, Wednesday, May 15th has been declared a national day of action to stop what they're calling the big telecom experiment that is the 5G rollout.
The main organizing group behind this effort is Americans for Responsible Technology, a 501c4 nonprofit representing more than 100 organizations from across the country concerned about the massive buildup of 5G technology in residential neighborhoods. Grassroots Environment Education is coordinating this effort. The group's executive director, Patty Wood, joined us by phone from Long Island in New York State.
Thanks for agreeing to be on our program, Patty.
Delighted to be here.
Could you provide us some background on your group and how it came to work with these other groups to formulate this strategy?
Sure. So Grassroots Environmental Education is an environmental health organization. We have a mission to educate the public about the links between common environmental exposures and human health. And it's really a big job because we have so many emerging environmental health issues in our lives today that we work on many, many different things from water contamination to plastics contamination to food systems and environmental exposures at schools and exposure to, to pregnant women and how that might be impacting, their child that's developing. And so there are a lot of different things that we are involved in. And the wireless revolution, or our wireless world, we call it, is something that we need to pay attention to just because it is so ubiquitous. You really can't get away from it anymore. It's in our homes, in our schools, in our places of work, in our restaurants and our coffee shops and our libraries and everywhere we go, we're being exposed to this type of radiation. Now, some people are particularly sensitive, and it has really been very, very difficult for them to manage to live normal lives anymore, just because they really feel physical pain and discomfort from being in places where there are, even the low levels, but certainly where there are significant levels of RF microwave radiation.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're trying to do is just educate the public, and we're trying to find ways to reduce those exposures, especially in places where the most vulnerable people are, and the most vulnerable are usually children. There are other vulnerable groups, like people with implanted medical devices, people who are already hypersensitive, to this type of radiation. So we're quite conscious of trying to protect those who really can't protect themselves just trying to create an awareness of this. And as people become more and more educated and aware of this, they will demand safer ways to use technology without having these health effects,
Patty,
both short-term and long-term.
Patty, how well is the public generally in terms of their information about what the dangers associated with the 5G rollout and wireless technology generally?
Really, they have really very little information.
Mm.
If you look at who our major advertisers are in media today, they are typically the telecom industry and pharmaceutical industry, just coincidentally. We're quite concerned that there is not a lot of information out there for the general public to get their hands on, to read about this. And, another thing about our organization is that we are a science-based organization, and there are a lot of medical doctors and researchers out there who have no financial stake, of course, in their work, and they are just out there, finding more and more and more things to worry about this type of radiation, especially since you can't get away from it anymore. And with 5G being rolled out, although it's in its infancy as far as the rollout of this this new generation of wireless technology, but this is going to make it really impossible, even in our neighborhoods, for people who have, who have always thought of their homes as a safe haven and a place where they can go and they don't have to be exposed to things. And now all of a sudden it's going to be this involuntary exposure which is basically, you'll like it or not, you're going to be exposed type of scenario.
Now, the Food and Drug Administration is working in conjunction with five other regulatory agencies, including the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, within a so-called radio frequency interagency work group. Mm-hmm. And the FDA states on its website the following, and I'm quoting, "According to current data, the FDA believes that the weight of scientific evidence does not show an association between exposure to radio frequency from cell phones and adverse health outcomes. Still, there is consensus that additional research is warranted to address gaps in knowledge, such as the effects of cell phone use over the long term and on pediatric populations." How do you make sense of the failure on the part of these oversight bodies to recognize the dangers that watchdog groups like yours are citing?
Yeah. So what's very interesting about that is that there was just recently when I say recently, over the past 10 years, the NIH conducted a study through their National Toxicology Program funded by taxpayers for $30 million to determine definitively whether or not cell phone radiation could cause cancer. This came about because the World Health Organization actually determined that that cell phone radiation was a possible human carcinogen, although there are some researchers now that think that that should be upgraded to a known human carcinogen. But nevertheless, we decided that we had to do our own study. So this study was designed, and then the design was approved by the FDA and the FCC and the EPA and all these agencies that you're talking about. And the study was approved, and it was conducted for all these years. And what happened at the end of the study, the data showed that there was clear evidence of carcinogenicity. That's their highest category, is clear evidence. And that was for tumors of the heart, schwannoma cells of the heart, tumors of the brain, the gliomas, and tumors of the adrenal glands. And then they found other tumor endpoints from that study in that had the classification of evidence, but not clear evidence, some evidence of carcinogenicity. But there was clear evidence. So then what do you do when you're an agency? I mean, the FDA is responsible for making sure that the devices that we use, the wireless devices that we use, which would be cell phones and laptops and so on and so on, are safe for humans to use or for the public. And then the FCC is supposed to make sure that the infrastructure, of course, which drives all of these wireless devices, is safe. And we have literally thousands of studies from all over the world showing that they absolutely show that there is a risk to human health. And we're talking about neurological and cognitive effects. We're talking about reproductive effects, cancers, as we just mentioned, people who have electromagnetic hypersensitivity, and so on. So we are very concerned that we, as a country, paid for this study to be done, and we came out with the results, and then we're just ignoring it. In fact, the FDA's response was, well, that's only in rats that they found cancer. Well, this is the way we study everything. We use the same rat models, for studying, the safety of pharmaceutical drugs and other things that become available for the public to purchase. And so it's ridiculous to say, well, no, we're not going to apply that to humans. We're just going to say that it's just the rats in the study that got cancer.
Mm.
So you can think what you want about that, but that's how that worked out.
Yeah. Do you have an opinion about the extent to which maybe regulatory capture, I think is the term?
Sure. I mean, you know what? I mean, this has been going on forever, that these agencies that are supposed to protect the public, especially the EPA and the FDA and so on, are staffed by and headed up by industry executives. It's the old revolving door situation. This is nothing new in Washington.
Hmm.
So they are, they're supposed to be you know, regulating an industry, but in fact they are enabling an industry. And that's just how it goes.
I imagine it's a challenge to publicly differ with these authoritative bodies without sounding like, to the general public, like Chicken Little. Can you talk about any pushback that groups like yours have encountered, be it from politicians, academics, media, or industry groups themselves?
Well, you know, what's really interesting is that, you know, this is science, and science has been, you know, relegated to, you know, to the back row right now, and we're not really listening to science. It's industry that, and their own science that industry pays for, that, you know, comes out making everything smell like roses, that they cite is their own science, but you have to always look at, at where the money comes from. It's, you know, follow the money. But all of this independent peer-reviewed research that we have, and to be honest with you, this is an extremely active field of scientific research. I mean, we're getting about 100 new studies every month, and that's a lot. That's a lot of studies, and none of these studies come back showing that there are no effects at all. So the fact that the FDA comes out and says, well, you know, we still think that more research needs to be done. Well, more research is being done. Lots of research is being done. If they would care to stop and read it and, you know, and actually take responsibility for protecting public health, that would be great. We would all appreciate that. The entire population of this country would appreciate if these agencies that are there to protect public health would do their job.
Talk about the May 15th day of action. Give us a few.
The May 15th day of action is really, you know, an opportunity for many of these groups around the country to actually educate more of the public in their area. It's also to show the telecom industry that they would like them to, you know, to do something to reduce the exposure to this harmful radiation. And, you know, I mean, we know that all of these industries are very powerful. They have very deep pockets. But there's really only one thing that's more powerful than money, and that's public opinion. And so this was actually inspired by several groups, but one in particular that was very active and said that we're going to have a rally, and we're going to, you know, bring moms with their kids, and we're going to talk about how, you know, we need to protect the most vulnerable in our society. We need to protect our kids in their own bedrooms, in their beds at night, from this 24/7, you know, exposure to this type of radiation, which we know from all this peer-reviewed science, you know, can cause serious harm. And so we thought, okay, that's a really good idea. So we just, you know, we got the word out to a few of these groups that we knew of, that we had been in touch with, and they're like, yeah, let's just do this. Let's do this all over the country. And we thought, okay, it's really, you know, it's just an opportunity for people to, you know, to get out there and get this message out, which is that we don't want to be exposed where we live. It's one thing to have a tower in a, you know, in an industrial park somewhere that's, you know, that's a half a mile away, which is giving us signals for our cell phones and our computers and so on, and that's just fine. But having these things on telephone poles and lighting poles all over our neighborhoods is another thing altogether.
Mm. Now, you're certainly encouraging people to do a lot of, you know, research. There's, you know, resources available at 5gcrisis.com, among others. What other actions, specific actions, are you encouraging people to take on once they've informed themselves?
Well, we're not really encouraging anybody to do anything, because the fact is that the FCC, back in September of 2018, last fall, actually did a rulemaking which took away all rights from the states and from local municipalities to do anything about the placement of these cells. And so you really have no options, you know, to speak of when the telecom companies come into your community and start putting up poles. There's really nothing that your local government can do about it. So that's why we need the telecoms. And I don't know what, I'm not sure what's going to happen, except that maybe there will be a little bit more awareness about this issue after the 15th, if any local media picks up on it. And that's really all we're trying to do. We're just trying to protect our kids. We're trying to protect an entire generation that basically have been exposed to this in many cases since before they were born. And, the results of these constant exposures and both near-field and far-field exposures to this type of radiation is very, very worrisome.
It seems like a very daunting challenge.
It's a huge challenge.
Yeah, the big wireless companies, they're so huge with all the financial resources they've got, politicians at their beck and call. But are there any success stories in the U.S. or elsewhere in the world that might inspire listeners with the understanding that fighting against this agenda is not a hopeless or quixotic battle?
Well, sure. I mean, there are places all over the world where they're just saying, nope, you're not going to roll it out here, like the Canton of Geneva in Switzerland. They prohibited the construction of 5G antenna. Done. And that was just last month, in April. They just said, nope, we are putting a ban on the construction of 5G antennas, and they're looking at investigations into the health implications. And, of course, the 1996 Telecommunications Act, the FCC Telecommunications Act, said you cannot fight the siting of any of these antennas based on environmental reasons. And then there was a lawsuit, and the judge ruled that environmental reasons also included health reasons. And so people are just afraid that they can't say anything about their children's health. They were worried about, all these exposures because the FCC law says, boom, can't say anything about it, can't fight it. But there are places where, there are states and there are lots of places around the world, like Brussels, for instance, Brussels in Belgium, they have halted a high-speed, 5G wireless internet due to the fears of health of citizens. Once again, it's all about the health. In France, they're not allowing, they're not even allowing, wireless in libraries and in some hospitals. And, so there are places around the world where they're beginning to look at the science and take it seriously. And that's what we're just trying to do. We're just trying to get people to look at the science. Here it is, in black and white. Just read it and tell me if you think this is a good idea after you read the science.
Patty, I want to thank you so much for sharing for this information and for your perspective, sharing that with our listenership. It's much appreciated.
You're welcome.
We've been speaking with Patty Wood, Executive Director of the nonprofit public interest group Grassroots Environment Education. You can access more resources about 5G, wireless, and other concerns in relation to the May 15th Day of Action at the website www.5gcrisis.com. Walt McGuinness is a Victoria-based political activist, citizen journalist, and co-host of Citizens Forum, a local political affairs program. He's also the past president of StopSmartMeters.ca, a citizens coalition to reverse BC Hydro's imposition of the so-called smart meter without due consultations and at great cost to British Columbians. Walt McGuinness appeared on Guerrilla Radio, the public affairs program hosted by Chris Cook, which aired on November 15th of last year on University of Victoria-based station CFUV 101.9 FM. The following is an excerpt from that broadcast.
The thing is that the fifth generation of this type of technology, they are now using an even higher frequency. It's 27 to 30 gigahertz frequency, which is about 10 times higher than what we're using right now. But they're also using a technology where the phones are like communicating like using laser beams.
Right.
Before, you were just chucking radiation out in the environment and hoping another receiver would pick it up and away we go. But this is aimed like laser beams. And now we know that this type of technology is dangerous. And this is the interesting thing about the connection with the University of Victoria, because the University of Victoria played a big role in developing this technology to use for military purposes. Right. And they developed the electromagnetic gun back in the late 90s and the early 2000s. And I've done access to information requests and dug up the people who are involved. But here we are at your university that you're sitting in right now. They developed technology using electromagnetic guns to harm people, and then they turn it around and say, oh, no, this technology's safe.
Well, yeah, we got to talk about that sometime. That's all news to me, Walt.
I know. It's astonishing. Well, but it is totally true. They, you know, the companies that were involved, that, you know, I did all the work on it. And, of course, they've all disappeared now, haven't they? Hmm. And when I did another access information last year in which they have none of this information is no longer available.
Right. So it just evaporates. I thought that stuff on the Internet was there forever. Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Grill Radio. I'm speaking today to Walt McGinnis. Walt is a Victoria-based political activist, citizen journalist. He co-hosts with Jack Etkin Citizens Forum over there on Shaw TV. He's also the past president of StopSmartMeters.ca. They stopped it for a while here. They got a moratorium on smart meter installation in 2011. I guess that was overturned then, Walt, because we got them now.
Well, they were able to do it, and I want to – you mentioned that, and I want to just give a special thank you to Sharon Noble for the work that she did on this, and she really did lead the way in the fight against the smart meters, and she still is. But, you know, the Union of B.C. Municipalities passed a resolution that asked for a moratorium on smart meters until they were – checked out to be safe and all that. The provincial government just ignored that and rolled it out. And there's no relief from that. I mean, it doesn't matter if it's the Liberals, the NDP, or the Greens, for that matter. None of them are looking at this issue seriously. Well, now, I want to mention something here before we get off the air, and that is, this is an appeal. This is the most exciting thing that's been happening in this issue for many, many years. Arthur Furstenberg from the Cellular Phone Task Force at one time, he and some friends have launched an appeal to all global governments. Now, anybody can go to the website and sign this appeal, and you can Google it. It's very easy. If you just Google spaceappeal.org, and you're going to not only find this appeal, but an incredibly concise and accurate review of the scientific status of this issue, as well as the political and social issues. So it's a great place to go if you want to go and learn about this.
Okay, it's spaceappeal.org.
Yes, correct.
Well, what does 5G look like now? I mean, I assumed when I first heard about it, it's just, you know, more of the same. But this means a transformation in infrastructure, and it's going to be, the costs of which look like, I mean, the Canadian government, I think the number I saw has already plopped down $500 million that they admit to, likely more considering the quality of the commercial I played earlier.
Oh, it's in the billions and billions of dollars, you know. The ramifications are astonishing. Now, the thing is, right up here in Brentwood Bay, they've already started to build a 5G network. Mm-hmm. Now, they place transmitters every 100 meters into a grid pattern in the neighborhood. So you say Brentwood, I've got around 100 or 110 transmitters on their streets now waiting for activation. And once that gets activated, there's going to be a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week emissions from those transmitters. And they're very close to homes and where people live and walk in their neighborhoods. Now, this is what's different, is that the radiation is coming in closer to us. These transmitters are in closer to us. They're much more higher power level. At a level now that we're seeing cellular responses that were never seen before, more acute responses. So it's not just a little bit of the same. No, this is a new technology that really, really attacks human health and all animals.
Well, that was my next question. I mean, if they're up higher on their people might have a sense of security that these transmitters are way up on top of light standards or telephone poles or whatever, wherever they're placed, communicating above our heads with each other. So, hey, you know, what it must the effects must fade.
Well, you know, you can kind of imagine like this. You know, everybody probably, most people have routers in their homes and their wireless routers and all that. Well, what's happening really is they're just putting their router out on the hydro pole outside their house,
mm-hmm.
and they're adding more features that you can do with it.
Well, when you say it's harmful not only to humans is where I was going with that. It's just like up there in the sky, there's birds, there's insects and stuff. What studies, if there have been any, Walt, have been done to meter the effects on other creatures?
Now, there is one. I just read it, and I wish I could find it here in my notes. But if you go to the spaceappeal.org and read the literature, you're going to stumble upon it. But in Puerto Rico, back in the 90s, they where they are monitoring insect life very carefully and doing research on it. And in 1997, they started to know that was an incredibly steep decline in insects. Up to a 70% or 80% decline in all insects,
mm-hmm.
and that was the year that they turned on their cellular phone network.
Right.
So, I mean, this is not a study; this is just an observation.
Yeah.
And you have to realize too, like globally, insects are dying in remarkable speeds,
yeah.
and all the controversy around I think called neonicotinoids.
Right. This is the bees and
the death of bees. Well, which is really, if you look at it, it could be associated with the death of bees. But what's really weakening bees, as well as all insects, according to a lot of this literature, is the radiation in the environment,
mm-hmm.
which is going up every day with all these new different technologies. So we are in trouble, Chris. I mean, mm-hmm. I know most people that are listening to us right today are just going to find some of this information shocking. Most will just shut down and not listen to it. And I think you and I both know that why do we do this? Why are we talking to each other? Well, we'd like to see some real changes, and we'd like to help educate the public of the real hazards. But the problem is that the threat is so great that we have the general public more or less locking up and not wanting to hear it,
mm-hmm.
because it's just too terrifying. It's like the discussion around climate change or the threat of nuclear war. Now we have this issue,
mm-hmm.
and it's just like most people are just shutting down.
Well, again, it's spaceappeal.org. I'm also looking at another site here, saferemr.com, and they've got a lot of links to articles. And this is from Dr. Joel Moskowski down in California there at the School of Public Health at the University of California, Berkeley. And it looks like a pretty good site as well. That's
SaferEMR. Oh, yeah. You know, the bioinitiative report is always good. If you can spell bioinitiative, you'll find it online.
Well, you're asking a lot of our audience. Just kidding, audience.
Because I spell it wrong every time.
Kidding.
But, you know, the bioinitiative report is a general review of the status of the situation, and they give out lots of advice and suggestions on how to change regulations and how to change them. And it's a very positive sort of report where the public can take that report and take that right to their leaders and say, okay, you guys, we got to change something, and this is a framework where we can use.
You can hear the entire interview by visiting GorillaRadio.com and scrolling down to the November 15th, 2018 archived show. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. Thanks this week to Chris Cook and CFUV's Gorilla Radio for sharing their interview audio. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.